The following interview was conducted with Freddie Riley for the Laurel County African American Heritage Center Oral History Project. It took place on August 20th, 2005, at the Laurel County African American Heritage Center in London, Kentucky. The interviewer is Laura Smith.
My name is Fred Riley, and I was born on March 28, 1943, in London, Kentucky.
Freddie, I was going to start off today by asking you a little bit about your early life. Can you tell me who your parents were and where they were from?
My parents were James and Edith Riley, and they were from London, Kentucky. And my father was a cook at the college.
At Sue Bennett College?
Sue Bennett College for 40 years.
And what did your mother do?
My mother did, early years, she did some domestic work, cleaning houses and stuff of that nature. And she also worked for the president of the college, Sue Bennett College.
What did she do for the president?
She did the cleaning in her house and everything.
Were they originally from Laurel County, both of your parents?
My mother was born in Clay County. My father, as far as I know, was born in London.
How did they meet?
I really don't know, but it was my mother was living in Pittsburgh and my father was living in London, and I guess they had met at church, and then they started their courtship from then.
Did you know either of your grandparents growing up?
Yes, I knew my grandfather. My grandmother, I do.
On which side?
My grandfather and grandmother on my father's side, and just my grandfather on my mother's side.
And what were their names?
My grandfather's name was Fred Douglas Riley, and I was on my father's side, and my grandmother was Lula Riley. And my grandfather on my mother's side was Barry Weird.
And do you know what kind of work that they had done?
My grandfather on my father's side, he worked at the Marymount Hospital for a short period of time. And after that, he did farming. Stuff like my mother, my grandmother, she didn't do anything.
And your grandfather, the Word?
He was a coal miner. He had worked in the mines in his younger years. He was a coal miner.
In Clay County?
In Pittsburgh.
In Pittsburgh.
He lived in Pittsburgh after coming from Clay County with his kids.
Did he come to Pittsburgh specifically to work in the mines there?
Now that I don't know. I think it was just time to move out of there, and he just decided to come this way.
So you would be related to Sophie Ward, is that correct?
Yes, I understand that was my great-great-great-grandmother.
Okay.
Yeah. They said she was a tough one. Never knew her, but I wish I hadn't known her back then.
Did you hear a lot of stories about
her? I've heard a lot of stories here lately about her.
What kind of stories?
About how she, in slavery, she was very, very mean, and you know, she was demanding orders. It's something she didn't like to take. And I also had, there was a little article in our history book about Sophie Word, but at the time, we didn't know who she was till we really got to my mother, and she told us that was her great-grandmother.
Where did you grow up, Freddie?
I grew up in North London.
North London?
North London, back in the hills. Right out there where my grandfather lived, right behind him, where he had his farm and everything. I grew up out there. I think I left there when I was 6 years old.
Now, when you say North London, what exactly area are you talking about? Where exactly would that be?
That would be on the north end by... down around where the dollar store is, down in there, and back so over in that hill.
East
yeah.
Bernstad still?
No, it's still no. London. Still London.
It's still down, London, okay.
Down by Kroger's on the other side of the hill.
Oh, okay.
North London, yeah.
And your grandfather had a farm there?
Yeah, he farmed, raised some chickens, some pigs, and some garden horses. He had a small little farm there.
Do you know about how much property he owned there?
It wasn't real big, but, you know, he had a house on it. And I had a couple of fields where he could plant corn. And it's still there today, you know. My aunt still lives there today on the property. The house where they live is vacant, but she has built her one on down a little bit further from there.
Did you grow up working on the farm?
No, I think I was a little too young. I mostly was in the way, but we had to do the chores, you know, with help with the feed, coal, cutting wood, that stuff, yeah.
And how many brothers and sisters did you have?
I had
helping you out?
Six brothers.
Six brothers?
Two sisters, yeah.
Two sisters. What were their names?
My brothers were James Riley, Delbert Riley, Chester Riley, Richard Riley, Barry Riley, Larry Riley. And my sister was Jackie Riley and Peggy. Peggy, yeah. And my two sisters, yeah.
And you said that you left your grandparents' home when you were six, living out there. Where did you guys move?
We moved to the, out on Falls Road.
On Falls Road?
Falls Road, yeah, we moved there from down by my grandfather when we lived down there. Went to Falls Road, and that's where I resided till I left town.
You left town. Where did you start out going to school? Missionary school.
The school I started on North Mill Street.
North Mill Street.
Yeah, at the old, I don't know. I guess they said it was Union Station or something. School down there it had been. But that's where I started going to school, in kindergarten. And I think it was 48.
And was that, and so that was a segregated school?
That was segregated, yeah, all-black school, yeah. Uh-huh.
Okay. And how many, what was the school like? Can you tell me a little bit about
it? Well, we had K through 8. Mm-hmm. And at one time there was two teachers, and from 1 to 4 and then 4 to 8. But the later years in 54, they cut it down to one teacher for the 8th grades. But there wasn't a whole lot of kids. 35 would probably be about the most kids back then.
Do you remember the teachers' names who taught there?
My first teacher was Alice Floyd. My first teacher. And my second teacher was Willene Floyd. My first teacher, she died. She got burned in a house fire, and she died. So her husband married this other lady, Willene, and she became my school teacher. She was from Henderson, Kentucky.
What was the school building like?
One room. We went down to one room. And the one teacher had to teach all the room and all the kids. And it was, education-wise, we didn't get a whole lot because she didn't have enough time to spend with each class, you know. And so we were, I felt like we were shortchanged on that end, but we had a lot of fun, you know. We didn't have all the gatherings and things like the other schools did, but we had a lot of fun.
What kind of materials was she using to teach out of?
The old-fashioned books they had back in the 50s, the reading books, and math. You know, I don't think we ever came up to date with our books because some of the things that other schools were teaching, we didn't learn that, you know. We were limited on the as far as education, but she would teach us, you know. She made it simple for her.
And how many years did you attend school?
I was there for 6 6 years.
6 years?
Yes.
And at that point, what happened?
We integrated in London in 1956.
1956.
And I attended London Elementary School in the seventh grade.
So tell me what that experience was like. Were you one of the first students who went into London Elementary?
Well, yeah, we kind of all from down there went together. But it was something that I never really thought I'd ever do, you know, and I really wasn't looking forward to that because, I don't know, even though I played with the white kids, you know, I didn't have no idea that we would be going to school together, you know, and it went over real smooth. I mean, they really accepted us in a manner in which they didn't, you know, it wasn't no fighting or nothing like that on my part. And I guess some of the lower kids might have had some kind of name calling and stuff, but I never was bothered with that when I went up there. But it was really exciting. The teachers were real acceptive of the black students that came there, you know. But we never thought that we would ever integrate, you know, and we would have to be faced with that, or we might have prepared ourselves, you know, in a way in which it'd have been a lot easier.
Well, how did you find out? When and how did you find out that you were going to be integrated into the school?
There were some problems that went down at the black school with the black teachers, and the parents had a lot of complaints about her, you know, favoritism and stuff like that. So the school board in London, they held a meeting, and we had to go to meetings, you know, to be witness what she was doing to the kids and all of that. So at that point...
Well, what kind of stuff was happening at the school?
Well, she had favorite students, and some kids would have to spend their recess in the classroom, never wanted to go, had to go out to play, and I probably was one of them. You know, so, you know, when my mothers got a hold of that, they felt like that it wasn't fair, you know, even though we might have been behind in our studies... They felt that we should have had a recess and then, you know, had other ways to bring that up. And so they really forced that issue. And then when the boards got through with it, that's what they came up with. And at the same time, they were integrating all over the United States. Yeah, so.
But was the issue more that it seems like it came more from the African-American parents, from the parents of children who were in the school pushing the issue rather than the London local government, you know, trying to follow national.
No, it was the parents. It was the parents, you know, and it was at a point that it was time for a change because we you know, actually we weren't progressing, you know. We might have been moving on, but our education wasn't up to the levels of the other kids. And so it was time for that move, you know. It was either that or get a new teacher because she had, you know, had built herself up. Well, she had favorite students, and they got to do this and do that, and other kids didn't.
And, I mean, there was only one teacher for
30-something. That's true, one, yeah, that's
kids.
Right. But I knew, you know, probably had a feeling it was coming because of the way that things was going down, you know, and the kids, the black kids... When they got in high school, they was going to Lincoln Ridge, and the city was paying part of their tuition, you know. So I knew that was gonna, you know, phase that sooner or later. But I was looking forward to going to that down on that level, you know, getting away from home. But I didn't get to make it. But it was a great experience, though.
Had you been following? I mean, were you aware at that time as a child the other places where children were integrating? Had you been following those news stories at all, or did you have a idea of what was going on a national level?
Yeah, I followed that real close, you know, and I had told my mother when it came up that we was going to have to go to the white school. Well, I just told my mother I'm not going to school there. And she said, oh, yes, you're going. And, you know, I thought, you know, from listening to Little Rock, Mississippi, and all the fighting and the rock throwing, and I thought it would be like that. So I said, you know, I don't want to be involved with that. But when we went there, you know, we probably went, our parents took us probably one at a time, you know. Well, my mother took all five of us up there. And the kids, you know, they looked at us, and I guess they went off to themselves and talked amongst themselves, but never said anything, you know.
Do you know at all how they had prepared the white students? If do you know anything about what might have been said in school to tell, to explain to them or tell them what was about to occur?
I can't say that they did, but it was one thing that was a plus for us. We had played with the white kids. We did this all the time, you know. So being together, we had an idea how each one of us, you know, performed when we was together. So that wasn't an issue. And now in the schools, they probably told them that there's going to be some black kids coming, and there we're going to have to do this. But we played with the kids, and so it made it a lot easier for a lot of us to go up there and play with them up there, go to school with them, because we had participated in playing. I played with them all my life. But that I think that really made it a little bit easier, because when I went there, I knew some of the kids. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What was that first day like? You said that your mother brought you guys to school. I mean, was anybody else there? Was the sheriff's department there or anything? Was there anybody making a big deal out of it, or did she just walk you up to school and that was it?
She walked us to school, and there was no sheriff, nothing. Mm-hmm. And we went to the principal's office, and he told us, you know, what room to go to. She enrolled us and everything, and there was no sheriff, you know, because I don't think that they had anticipated any kind of problems, because it was such a small community, and we were all, the blacks and the white were close-knit. I mean, you know, we communicated every day. We lived next to them and stuff like that. So they didn't really anticipate having any problems. That's the way I felt, you know. And I guess there were some problems, probably. I never was faced with any. Now, some other little kids, you know, small kids, you know how they could be. They might have been faced, but I never was faced with any problems. But I met friends. The guys are real nice. The girls, they're real nice. Teachers, you know. But I never had a problem with them, you know.
So you always had a good experience with
them. Yeah, it was a great experience, you know. And then it was so much different than what we had been used to when it come to learning, you know, our English and stuff like that, history. It was all different, you know. And so, actually, being in the seventh grade, I probably was about 2 years behind in some of that stuff, because I had never been exposed to it at school. So that put me behind the other kids, you know, when it come up to learn. They was way ahead of me, and learned, they caught on real fast. And I just didn't understand it, especially English. But it wasn't long, you know. We got into the flow.
So did you just sort of have to pick up the slack, or were there people, teachers there to sort of help you, who recognized that the school you'd been at before wasn't exactly up to par with?
Yeah, they kind of, you know, took us by the hand and went slow with us, you know, even though it held the other kids back a little bit, because they were far advanced in that. But they took their time with us, you know, and they made sure that we did learn. The part they was trying to teach us, you know, they just didn't leave us there. They was made sure that we understood what was going on, you know.
And so how big was the class that you went into in seventh grade?
I went in, I'd say there was, in the classroom, there was about 35 kids in the class that I was. And we had the seventh grade, it was broke down into two different rooms, you know. And I was in one room, and my brother was in another room, and I think I might have been, I know I was, the only black in that classroom, you know.
Did that make you feel you know, strange at all, having yeah. come from, you know, a one-room schoolhouse where everyone was African-American to being the only, you know?
Yeah, that really, you know, and I had to learn, pick up friends real fast because, you know, I didn't have my brothers and other friends in there with me, you know, and I was the only black, and so, you know, I adjusted to them well, and they kind of took me on their wings and showed me the ropes, you know. I really enjoyed that part of it. The first year was the hardest.
So what did you think, you know, that first day? Because you had said before you told your mother that you weren't going to go because you thought it was going to be difficult, and I guess. Is that right?
Yes.
And then, so what did you think when you came home that evening?
I recall my mother asked me, how did you do? And I said, I did okay, you know, and I went right on up on the hill and played. But me and my brothers, we talked about it, you know, we amongst ourselves that it wasn't bad as we thought it was going to be. And we talked about some of the kids and some of the things that went down, you know, they was exposed to in the lower grades, you know.
So what did they tell you?
They told me, you know, we all agreed the same thing, that it wasn't bad and that we're not faced with any kind of racial stuff. And, you know, that I think that really made us all feel good. And then it gave us, you know, incentive. We wanted to hurry up and get back because we wanted to know what the second day was going to be like, you know. And same way, you know. Most of the kids were very, very, except, you know, and then after school we played with them and everything. But, you know, you're going to have that a little bit. But that wasn't bad, you know. It just wasn't no rock throwing, fighting, none of that.
And so you continued on at London Elementary through 8th grade?
8th grade, right.
Okay, and then you went to, were you transferred then to one of the high schools?
Yeah, I was London High School, yeah. After my 8th grade, when I was in 8th grade, the following year, I started out, they had a basketball team, and I started out, I didn't really know that much about it. But I said, I'm going to go out here and I'm going to do the best I can. So I went out there, started playing basketball, and I really caught on real fast, you know. And I got to be a starter out there, you know. And that year, which was in 1957, I played in a tournament down at Pittsburgh, and I was voted one of the most valuable players for the tournament. And I received a gold basketball. I think that was one of the first awards any black had received from that school, you know.
And you were one of the, were you the first African-American basketball player?
Yeah.
To play on an integrated team, is that
yeah,
correct?
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I played 57. I had to sit out about a few weeks till I got my grades up, but I started playing. I was the starter on the junior varsity team, and I dressed for the varsity. And that was really tough, you know. Going away, playing on the road, you know, that was really tough.
How was it tough?
Well, a lot of the places, there had never been no blacks in there playing. Hazel Green, Bush, Lily, Corbin, Clay County, Mount Vernon. And so you're there, and I would be the only black in a gym. I had my friend, James McKee. He was the stat man for the ball team. So he would be up there at the scores table, you know. And I was down on the floor, so yeah.
You'd be the only two African-Americans in the building?
And it was tough. You know, you look around and say, how am I going to play this game? You know, you want to do your best, but I was a very physical ball player, so, you know, you got to be careful because you can't knock them down because you don't know what they might do. So that kind of hurt me because the way I played. I was very, very physical, and the guys, you know, I think the guys was more lenient than the parents. I think the parents were the ones that was creating a problem from the crowds. You know, it wasn't the kids.
So tell me about those experiences when you would go into an auditorium out, like, say, in Hazel Green or somewhere where there weren't a lot of African Americans who lived there, and then there certainly weren't any, you know, playing on the basketball team. What would that experience be like for you?
Well, I would always try to be, when I came in a gym, I'd always try to be the last one. And, you know, everybody was looking. They knew that they had African American out there, and so they wanted to see who he was, you know. And I'd always be the last one in there, you know. And they would look at me and everything, you know. But then when I came up, go down, dress, and come back, you know, that's when it all started, you know, warming up. And they want to boo you and all that. A few name calling, but
and would it be the kids or the
parents? It was more the parents and stuff. Because back then you had some diehard supporters. I mean, win was a thing, you know. And they felt like they were threatened when they saw me come out on the floor, you know, because I don't know why, you know, I'm just out there to play a game like the rest of them, but they felt threatened. And they would do a little bit of everything to you, you know. Stand around the floor and they may want to kick you. But, you know, you just had to be strong. I try to be strong, but still, yet I was scared. I had a lot of fear. And I felt like today that I didn't get to play my best at them schools because of what I was up against, you know.
Because you felt like you couldn't be as physical.
That's right.
Because you were scared that you might hurt somebody if you pushed somebody
yeah.
down.
I did better. They knew when they come up here they had a problem because I could play my game. And then they had a job on their hand trying to stop me.
So did you feel like the London community was supportive
of
you
then? Oh, yes. We had some of the greatest supporters in basketball, teachers and business people. They were really great, you know. And they pushed us all forward, you know, and, you know, try to keep us kind of calm. Whenever things got a little tough, they'd call and say, hey, don't be scared. Just go on out there and play your game, you know. One of the main supporters that I really admired was Harry Houchins. He's a great guy. He was owner of a Begley drugstore in town. He was a great guy, him and his wife. They really supported me in the game, you know. In fact, all of my brothers that played sports, they really was behind them, you know. And that made you feel good, you know, when
sure.
especially when you was at home.
He would come up and personally say things to
yeah.
you or just let you know. That
every at home games, he'd always come talk to me. While I was warming up, he'd come out there and talk to me. And, you know, he'd just give me a little support. And it made me feel good, you know. But the road trips was terrible.
Now, we've talked about this before, and you've described to me being out at some of these counting schools and having the parents actually be lining the floor, you know, around the perimeter.
Yeah.
Where did that happen at, and what exactly happened?
It was the schools, Hazel Green, Bush, and Liddy, their gymnasium was very small, and they were limited to the amount of people. So they would line the floors, you know, all around the floor and just wherever they could stand. And that was pretty tough because you could, if you had to go out of bounds to throw the ball in, they had a tendency to do little things, you know, where the referee didn't see it, you know.
Like what?
You know, they might pinch you or push you, stuff like that.
And was it only directed towards you?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. It was me, you know. They was trying to get at me, you know. But I just, you know, try to ignore it and keep on going. I didn't really try to create a problem. If there had been two or three of us, now we might have, you know, got together and said, hey, we're not going to take it no more, you know. But when you're by yourself, you have a tendency to take a lot more than you would if there was somebody with you. But at the same time, the referees and all of that was still against you, too. That was still a problem, you know. They hadn't came across being officials. They did not act professional. They would give, you know, the white guy would get a break. You, it was on you. You know, this way it was in all phases. I encountered that all over. I even encountered that at home when we played home games. You know, the refs, they won't give me no breaks. You know, because I don't know. I guess they say, well, he ain't supposed to be here no way. But I just had to, you know, probably about not every home game, but every other, I had fouled out because they would call it, you know. They would put it, if it was a close call, it went on me. But, you know, that was okay. The coaches understood, you know. They didn't create a problem either, you know.
Psychologically, Freddie, what was that experience like if you show up and you have adults who are lining the floor and then adults who are referees and, you know, acting in this way? How did that make you feel, you know, and you're just a kid, I mean, a teenager at that point, just trying to play a game?
I kind of felt like that my rights were violated, you know. It was a form of child abuse, you know, but I couldn't say nothing, you know. And then the coaches already knew what I was, stress I was under when I was playing. They would even tell me, especially when we went to Mount Vernon, they would set me down the day before and they said, "You know what you're going to be up against now. It's going to be up to you whether you can go out there and play with all of this." And I said, "Well, I'm going to do the best I can, you know." But they knew everything, but I think their hands were tied too at that point, you know, because in order for it to be everybody to back all the ballplayers, they had to come over, you know, and they wasn't ready to go, you know, one way. They weren't going to back me as much as they should have, but they were there, you know, but they just didn't do it like they should have, I don't think. But the ballplayers, you know, they knew what I was going up against, you know. And they tried to keep me calm, you know, the guys I was playing with. But it was just that as the years went on, the exposure got more and more, and it made it a lot easier for the ones behind me. But I was out there first, so I got all up at the end.
So why did you do it? I mean, didn't you want to quit at some point? And I mean, you describe it, and I've heard you describe it before as a form of child abuse, you know, having to go out there and listen to people, I'm sure, you know, yelling and even sometimes threatening physical violence, yeah. You know, pinching and stepping on you. You know, why did you continue to do it?
Well, I was determined to be successful at that level. I wasn't going to let them stop me. They might slow me down, but they weren't going to stop me. And I never thought about, it got tough, but I never thought about quitting. I said, well, I'm just going to keep on, just see how far they'll go. See if there's any break ahead, you know. That was, that started off in 1957. And I said, well, see how far they'll go, you know, with it, you know. And it didn't, my 4 years, it never got any better, you know. It just, because there was no more black kids coming into them gymnasiums. There's very few that would come in there and play.
Now, you did play with an African-American ball player from Monticello.
Peyton.
What was his name?
Peyton. I forget his first name, but his last name was Peyton. He was a great ball player, yeah. Me and him, we would talk about the game. I don't think Wayne County, that was one school. Monticello, I don't think they had it as bad because there was more blacks. When he came in, it was three or four came together, you know, and so it made it a lot easier for him. And the school accepted them because he was a great ball player and everything, and they accepted him because there was more with him, you know. And it would have probably been a lot easier for me if there was at one time there was a couple more of us. My brother played with me. And John Floyd, he played 1 year with me. So I felt more comfortable playing, knowing them guys were there. You know, I said, well, I got somebody to battle with now. But that was just 1 year, 1960, when they played with me.
And that was your final year?
No, my final year was 61.
61, okay.
61, I continued on 61.
And they didn't continue in 61?
John Floyd graduated in 60, and my brother, he didn't play 61.
Why didn't he play?
I don't think he made team. He got a little too tough. But then he joined the service, too, in March of 61. So he went away. And I was still out there by myself, you know. It was really tough. And going to, if you had to eat, that was a big problem.
What was that like when you had to go places and you couldn't eat with your team?
You know, I often think about that today. I didn't really have a thought about it. You know, I said, oh, it's very sad that I can't eat with the players, you know, but I'd go to the kitchen and I was taken care of back then. The black lady, she would always cook, especially in Harlem. That's one that I really remember for 3 years. I did this, and she was very, very nice. She'd always be looking for me when she knew I was coming, and she'd fix me up like that. I think I got to eat a little bit more than other guys because she'd give me some pie and stuff like that. Took care of me. But that was tough, not, you know, being a, when we in football, we when we'd go away, we would order the food and bring it on the bus instead of creating a problem.
But in the basketball, you would have to go eat in the kitchen,
yeah. Mostly it was in the kitchen, yeah.
In the kitchen.
Mm-hmm. And,
did the other players ever say anything or show you any support, or the coaches,
nah,
or that was...
They never said anything. I guess it's, you know, probably in the back of their mind they were thinking, you know, why is this, you know, but they never made a problem, you know, because it was... I don't think it would have been a problem with the coaches, but they just didn't mention it, you know. We just went on just like we was all together all the time, you know. Especially when it comes to playing the game. We went on out there and did what we had to do. But that was a sad time, you know.
But was it still like that in London? Were the restaurants still segregated at that time in London?
They were.
Right.
I don't think there was one that we could go and sit down and eat. No, there wasn't one.
Did you have an idea at all at that time that was illegal?
No.
No.
But we were steady following what was happening. The marches in the South and all the lunch counter, the integration, all that stuff. We were steady following that, but they were still having problems down through there, so we felt like it wasn't time for us either. But it was real tough, you know. And I don't know when I left in 61, so I don't know when things changed.
So even in 61, when you left London, the restaurants were still segregated, even though you guys had integrated the schools or playing on integrated ball teams, the restaurants were still segregated.
They were still segregated, yeah. You know, there was no lunch counters, you go sit down. You know, because, you know, being in London, the people that live around here in London, they were more likely to accept it, but you had people coming from the counties that was not exposed, so they didn't accept that, you know. In order to keep everything down, they just said, no, we'll wait till it's time, and then we'll do it. But I think the county schools were, they were the toughest, you know. They didn't, I don't know when they integrated. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't, I left in 61, there was no integration down there. It might have been 62 or 3 when they students went down there, because the kids from East Merced had to go to Hazel Green or London. It was the only choices they had. But I think a lot of them tried up here to go, and they said, well, you're going to have to go to Hazel Green. And they were very hesitant about going to Hazel Green because that was tough. There's some tough guys down there, you know.
Did you ever have, going back to the basketball games, were there ever any incidents of violence or threatening?
On the court?
On the court or off the court?
No, because a lot of the guys that I played against, you know, from even Bush and Hazel Green, you know, like on weekends, we might meet up in town, and we'd all talk, you know, and everything. There never was a whole lot of violence. You know, we might have did a little trash talking on the floor, but no, there was no violence.
But more so, I mean, with the parents, because you had said that they were the ones, you know, it was more the adults coming out who were the
parents were very, you know, they recognized everybody on their team, and it wasn't, they didn't recognize you even when you weren't playing ball, you know, they didn't have nothing to say to you, you know. Like, you know, usually the parents, you know, say you played a good game or something like that. Tell them, no. They were just so diehard, you know. They wanted to win. And whatever it took to win, that's what it was. But it was...
So then did you take it more of just it was their desire to win or that they were racist? They were yelling, you know.
I think it was a combination. Of both, you know, because they felt, you know, I guess they the black ball players, you know, they were just beginning in all phases. I'm talking college and everything, and they knew how dominant the black ball players was. So this was a thing that really threatened them. They said, "Well, we get one here, and he's going to be terrible. You know, he's going to do this and do that." So this is the way they felt, and they was not going to ease up. They was going to say, "Yeah. We don't want to see him. We don't want to see him come up in here. You know, we're gonna make it tough on him." And they did. You know, physically, it probably wasn't that bad, but mentally, it took a toll on me mentally. You know, when you go out there and you hear all this screaming and all these racial stuff, and you're trying to play, you know, and you know you want to do this, but you say, "Should I do that?" You know.
And what kind of stuff would people yell at you while you're on the court?
They would use the N-word just about all night, you know. And it really got to me. But still yet, I try to do the best. I try to block it out, which you can. But I said, well, Freddie, you're going to have to live with it. After the first year, I said to myself, it's got to get better, you know. And it just continued on. It seemed like there's more and more. But I didn't let it stop me, but it slowed me down, you know, and I felt like I could have been a better ball player if I had somebody there with me to help me out and bring the best out of me, you know, because I was scared. I wasn't the bravest person out there. I was a little scared.
Did you ever talk to your parents about it when you come home?
My mother used to go to some of the games locally, and she would go to... She wouldn't go to the county schools and all, it was a little too tough. But Barbersville, she'd go up through there with me sometime when she got a ride. And she heard this, you know, and everything. But she would always ask me, you know, was I scared or how did I feel, you know? And I said, "Yeah, Ma, I was a little scared." But I said, "I knew y'all was up there and y'all had my back." So I felt comfortable with some in the audience really helped me out, you know, when they would come to the games. That helped me out a lot. Knowing what, if I looked around and seen two or three of them, I said, okay, I can play pretty good today. But Clay County was another, that was a guy over there in Clay County that I'd always look, on the weekend I would see him. If I was coming over there, I would say, "Jack Hipsher." And I tell Jack, I said, "Jack, I'll be over here on Tuesday." He said, "Okay, I'll be there." He said, "Look for me." I said, "Yeah, okay." So I'd always find him up there in the crowd because he was a pretty powerful man over there in Clay County.
And he was white?
He was black. He was black. Yeah, he was a big one. And he, you know, the Hipsters, they were pretty tough over there. And they had a good name, you know, and he didn't take no mess. So they respected him. So I look up and I see him. I said, "Well, I'm going to be all right now. There'd be Jack up there." But it was... not too many places you find guys like that, you know. He'd be about the only black at the game. He'd be the only black there. But I'd always let him know I was coming. Other places there was none.
And one time you had made the comment to me that part of the reason that it was scary is because you never wanted to be the only black anywhere, you know.
No.
And so how did that feel a lot of times when you were, you know, like you said, you and the scorekeeper maybe.
Yeah, it was tough. You know, and I never wanted to be the only one. I always wanted to be, you know, three or four, a group of us, you know. And I find myself now in situations like that now as I done got grown. I mean, you know, I might, at work, I might be working at a department. I'd be the only black in that department. I said, why me, you know? And even where I live at today, I'm the only black guy over there. And there's only two of us. Marjorie Bush, she's always one of us. Two blacks over there. And it's, but you know, right now it's different. And I can deal with it, you know, because I'm just... I voice my opinion, you know, and I can talk to people, and I respect them, and I demand the respect in return, you know. So now it doesn't bother me as much, but it is something. I said, why do we end up me? I'm the only black. Why? So I want to bring everybody with me, but it just don't work out like that.
It just seems, you know, with having that fear and not wanting to be the only one, you know, the fact that you know, chose to be the first ball player and you really put yourself out there as a leader and as a trailblazer. I mean, it seems pretty extraordinary to me that you would do that.
Well, you know, we all started out, you know, and I was, we didn't know a whole lot about the game when I went there in 57. So, you know, I was always willing to learn and everything. And I guess the coaches, they saw me and I had a leaping ability, and so they kindly pushed me out there. Well, at the same time, I was trying to get the other guys to come on, let's go and let's see what we can do, you know. And when it come for the tryouts and everything, we everybody would try out and they would all of them get cut, and now they end up with me, you know. And I stopped. But I was determined to be one of the best. When I went out there, I was determined to be the best.
Do you think that they really, did you ever think about why they got cut? Was it really because they didn't have the ability, or do you think that at that time they only wanted one?
Well, that is something to look at, too. And I think some of them that were cut were just as good as some of the white guys they kept. Mm-hmm. But they didn't want to get a large number of blacks, mm-hmm. and then that would create another problem, you know. Mm-hmm. So the parents said, well, you cut my kid and you put a black one out there, you know. So I think some of the blacks that they cut were qualified to play, but they just said, well, we got one here, so we'll go with him, see how he does. There never was no more than three of us in my 4 years. No more than three of us out there at one time. And I think it was, they didn't want it to get out of hand, you know. If there was a... about 9 or 10 of us up there, you know, we all, 7 of us had the ability to really perform in the game. Would they keep 7? No. There's no way they could do that, you know, because predominantly white schools, you got to have that white, outnumbered the blacks, you know. You can get 3 and then you'd have 9 white ball players, you know. They was not going to give us that edge, 50-50, nothing like that. But I think they did cut some of the ball players that were qualified to play with me, you know.
In the local paper, in the media, did you receive the same amount of attention as the white ball players? Or?
Oh, yeah. We had a sports writer that followed sports in London. His name was Dave McDemon, and he did the sports. And, you know, I would talk to him about it every day, you know. And he'd always give me a good write-up and everything. He just told it like it was, you know. If you didn't do nothing, he'd write it up too. He's lazy. But he was a great sports writer, and he was a sports fan. And he gave equal, it was an equal opportunity for all of us, you know, when it come to writing. And you know, and the people really liked me. And I was a good ball player. And they let me know, you know, that I was good, you know, and my coaches would say, you know, you're going to be one of the best around here. Just keep it up, you know. And I try to do my best, you know. In practice, I would just dominate the game, you know. And then I was trying to get me a starting position. I didn't want to be coming off the bench. I wanted to play. So on my second year, I went out there and I just gave it all. But that, you know, you still had a few ball players that, you know, they kind of felt bad, you know, jealous. And I mean, by me not really knowing that much about the game when I started, and to be that successful in a few years, they really wanted to talk about it. But yeah, all in all, we play every day. We play Mill Street down there. We had some goals. We play every day. And rain or shine, we'd be out there.
And then you guys, you said that, you know, there were a few who were sort of envious of your talent or where you got with it. But did they ever cause a problem or?
Well, there was one instance back in 1957 when I was in eighth grade. I was, after our season had ended in the elementary school, the coach told me, he said, I want you to come and practice with the junior varsity high school team. And I said, okay. So when I went out there to practice, you know, we'd be out there, you know, and when we would start scrimmaging, they didn't want to pass me the ball, you know, and they would hold it off, you know. And that didn't bother me too much. And then later he told me, he said, well, I want you to dress for the game. And then he wanted to put me in there as a number six man. You know, I'm thinking, yeah, I ain't that good. You know, these guys been playing longer than me. But see, then that was a conflict there. I'd get out there and they wouldn't throw in the ball or nothing. So I kind of backed up. One game I was supposed to dress and I didn't even go because I knew what to expect out of them, you know. But sooner or later they came around. And a lot of them kids that was playing then, further on up the years, they didn't make it through it, my years, you know. So I came into some new guys, you know, some guys that really wanted to be team players, and they didn't care what color you was, you know, we want to win this game. So that helped me out. We had some real great ball players out there. Bobby Hiller, Blake Lee Tanner, Tanny Phelps, all them guys were good. And we worked together pretty good.
Did your team do pretty well on a regional level?
Never did. We would win maybe one regional tournament. We might win one game. We never did have a chance to go to state, nothing. Because the teams were so, they were far advanced, you know, Somerset, Monticello. And through there, they were a lot more advanced than we were. And so we never got that far. I think out of 4 years, I think I went to a regional 3 years. And one year we won one game. It was in the championship, we didn't win. But it was, you know, it was a great learning experience, you know. And we played hard, but just too much talent in other teams, you know. Too well balanced. But it was really great out there, you know. And as I look back over the years, the things that I would change about my, you know, I would try to be more, not so much scared, but more forceful. But that's what I say now. But back then, it wasn't possible. I mean, you could do it, but the consequences was far beyond, you know, what you can imagine. If you hurt one of the ball players and stuff, you know, them people would they would do something bad to you. But it was all right. I succeeded. I wanted to go to college, but I don't know. I was tired, I guess. Tired of school. I was going to Sue Bennett. My father, he worked there, so, you know, I could go over there. And I had been talked to by the coach, and he wanted me to come over there and play, but I told him I would, but I said, no, Freddie, you really had enough of that. You know, and I would have been faced. Their ball club, you know, I've been faced with the same stuff.
The college club,
because they played in somebody where there was no blacks. Lindsey Wilson, a lot of them schools didn't have any black guys.
And you were just tired of that. You just didn't want to do it anymore.
That was the end of that for me, you know. I had enough of that. And I left and went to the city. And that was a whole new experience to city life. You know, it's you get around in the city. You're in the city, and you're maybe on the west side of town, you know, and it's all you have is blacks, you know. There's a few whites live over there, but when you go up on the street, it's nothing but blacks, you know. And I got used to that. 61, about 64, I was really into it then, you know, and I was listening to my brothers. They were playing, you know, and I always kept in contact with them, you know, that's how they were doing it. What was they facing in as far as the race thing? And they faced a little bit of it, but it wasn't on a large scale because it had already, you know, the thing had already been said when I was out there. So they knew me coming out there was going to be more behind me. So they had learned to accept, but they still had a little racial stuff and everything. They were encountered a little bit of it.
Did you feel responsible for, you know, your brothers having a little bit of an easier time?
Yeah, I did. I told him, I said, you know, I'm not going to be as great as I should be or as good. I said, but y'all got an opportunity to be way better than me. I told my brother, and he was one of the dominant guys around here, football and basketball, Richard Riley. Mm-hmm. He's in the Hall of Fame. They have a Hall of Fame. He's in the Hall of Fame. But I told him, I said, you got an opportunity because...
And you're not in the Hall of Fame?
No, not London. Not yet.
Not yet.
Might go down. He's
and
one.
They've never given you any recognition for being the first? Or
No. But the coach that came in that coached my brother in football, he never knew the guys from the 50s. Mm-hmm. So he starts the Hall of Fame. So he uses players in the era that he was there and that he knew. He didn't research and go back and say, okay, who were some of the great ones here back in the 50s, you know? And if you're going to start a Hall of Fame, you've got to go back and reach them. I think right now we've got, I know one guy that I played with, Blakely Tanner, he was inducted a few years ago. Mm-hmm. But my brother was number one. He went in at number one, top player.
Mm-hmm. So do you feel, I mean, how do you feel about it now in your life, knowing that you were not the ball player that you could have been?
I feel like I was shortchanged, you know, and the time I came up, I guess you'll have to look at that and say, well, Freddie, it wasn't time for you to be so successful. You was out there doing a job. It's just like when you were digging a ditch, you was the one that started it. So, you know, the other ones behind you was the ones that was going to get all the fame and glory when it comes down to inducting the Hall of Fame, stuff like that. But I knew I could have been better. But with the fear that I had, you know, that the way I had to play, the things I had to play on, I just couldn't be. It's because I wanted to be. And I would you know, at home, I would just dominate, you know. But on the road, I just couldn't do it because I had that fear. And I guess that's probably a lot of the ball players from the 50s. They had that. The exposure was really... it wasn't time for them to really be successful. You take Oscar Robertson, some of them ball players, they came out there, but they was in some of that, the segregation, you know, the motels and that stuff. They went through that too, you know, but it was more of them. And they bonded together and said, this is not going to hold us back. We might not be able to eat with them, but when we get on the floor, they'll know we're here. See? So that is a way of looking at it. If you got more people there with you to kind of push you on and everything. I didn't have that.
What kind of, back up for a second and talk about, what kind of, you said that you had followed, you know, very closely what was going on in other parts of the country as far as the civil rights were concerned. Was there any connection to what you were doing in your life with the civil rights? I mean, did you look at the things you were doing, like integrating into school or being the first, you know, African-American ball player? Did you have an idea of that being within the context of the civil rights, of that you were doing something?
Not really at the time, you know, but, you know, going along with what was happening in the world, at that time, that gave us a gave me incentive. You know, I'm watching them, and at the same time, I'm finding out what to do and what I can't do. You know, and this made it a lot easier for me. Because I followed them, and I said, well, you know, I can't do that, you know. I can't go with these girls. I can't do that. So they made it a lot easier for me, where if you go out there blindly and you might jump into something that, you know, like Emmett Till when he went down south from Chicago, you know. And, you know, I was in Chicago, but he didn't know that he couldn't do this down there, and so he cost him his life. So I followed up with that, and that way it kind of gave me a pattern to go by at the time, you know. And I didn't ever try to go to a lunch counter because I already knew. I mean, I thought it would be stupid of me to go, no, okay, I want to sit down. They said, no, you know, you can't do that. And I didn't even try that because I knew I couldn't do it.
What did you think about, though, the people that were doing that?
I thought it was a great move, you know, if it was a group of them and they stuck together.
They had a group.
Yeah. See, where you got one or two, it's you're defeating your purpose. As a group, you can be successful in changing things if you go as a group and stick together.
But then there were individuals, too.
Well, yeah, and they, you know, they caught flak, but they would go back and regroup, and they say, okay, I can't do this on my own, so I got to get somebody to help me out, you know.
So there wasn't really, did people in the community, in the black community in London, were you guys talking about what was going on in other parts of the country?
Yeah, we would talk when we got together. We would talk about it and, you know, and really just give our opinion to each other, you know, how we felt about it.
What kind of opinions would be expressed? What were
you
saying
that,
at that time?
We thought there was... You know, what harm was it doing going to a lunch counter, sitting down to eat with somebody, you know? Mm-hmm. What harm did it do, you know? And we really didn't understand what it was all about. I really didn't understand why we couldn't sit down and eat together here. I didn't really see that. I said, why? Well, what's it hurting, you know? I thought it was a shame that the people couldn't get together, that, you know, and we're all striving for one thing, you know, and people look at, you know, going to heaven. Well, it's not segregated there, you know. So why can't we all live together down here and achieve some of these things together? And then, you know, I think it hurt them more than it hurt us. Because they worked harder trying to stop us, mm-hmm. where we weren't working as hard trying to do it. See, and so it hurt them, you know. It held them back, you know. And then when they found out that it was going to be done, then they found us. You know, we wasted all that time, and it's still gonna happen. And that's the way I felt about the whole ordeal. But I still didn't push the issue, you know.
So there wasn't, I mean, really a movement in this part of the state, do you feel like? No.
Nope.
Maybe up in Lexington and Louisville, would you follow what was going on?
I don't think, you know, I'm saying that in Lexington, I think they had, I don't know what year it was that they... integrated down there, because they had Lexington, Dunbar, Lexington, Douglas. They were all black schools. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking if it's around 57, 56, 57, they did it too. Because I recall going in about 58 playing football at Bryan Station. They just built Bryan Station school down. And they had blacks, you know. And I don't think their movement was as smooth as ours, but I don't think it was publicized as much as it was in Mississippi. You know, because this is something they kept down because they felt like if Lexington was exposed, then this would spread to Louisville, then some of the other towns would get into it, and there you got a great big thing going on. So they didn't publicize it as much. And back then we didn't have... TV wasn't a big deal. In fact, I never had TV. But the news never... He never had it. The world news would bring it. If you had TV, you could see it on the world news. But far locally, I don't think they televised any of that reactions from their integration.
Didn't. I mean, the Lexington Herald didn't really cover it. They even ran, I guess was it last year? They ran on the front page an editorial apologizing for not covering the civil rights movement. Because they just didn't cover it at all. It was sort of...
I don't know. But I guess they had their reasoning at the time. I guess they said, well, you know, we steady feed it, it's going to steady grow. And so the more we plant, the more stuff that's going to happen, because everybody wants to get into the flow of it. You know,
felt like it would have been stoking the fire.
Oh, yeah. I do. I know it would be, you know, because it happened all over. You know, whenever they was public, the world news publicized what's happening in Mississippi, then in Arkansas, they found a way to get theirs going, too. They said, Mississippi's doing this. Let's get together and let's do it, too. You know, let's create the problem, you know.
Did you see, though, sort of a division, though, between here being, living in rural southeastern Kentucky as opposed to being deeper south? I mean, did you see a distinction, though, between... I mean, there definitely were, you know, slave owners here in Clay County, Manchester, yeah. There was an auction block there. You know, yeah. I mean, there was definitely slave ownership here, but not to the extent as it was maybe, you know, deeper south.
Deeper
do
south,
you think?
Yeah.
Did you ever feel like race relations were different here than maybe deeper south? Was there a distinction being in the mountains? And
I think so. I think that you know, the whites and the blacks here, they come in together. Together more than they did down in Mississippi. In Mississippi, they, you know, they were slaves and they sharecroppers and stuff like that. Here, here in London, you know, I don't think he had the sharecropper, you know, but they had their own little farms, and I think they all communicate to a certain extent.
And that's what this paradox is, that, you know, you've told me before, you know, growing up, you always played with white kids, everybody, you know, you lived next door to each other, neighbors, everybody sort of always helped each other out. But then in public spaces, I mean, you couldn't go, even if you had a friend who was white, you guys couldn't go to a restaurant together. In London, in this area, was very, very late, you know, integrating.
Yes,
so I mean, what did you think about, what was that paradox sort of about, where I've heard you and other people say, you know, we've always lived together. You know what I mean? It was never segregated like other parts.
Oh, I think that one thing that went on there, the blacks never did get together and make that an issue. Mm-hmm. And they never would have got together as a group to change things. And this is one thing, we were just... They were more satisfied with what they was doing. It wasn't affected them, you know, because they felt like they're not going to eat out that much anyway. So this was not a big issue for the blacks, you know. They would go cook their beans and everything and go on, you know, like that. It wasn't a big issue. Where in Mississippi, they always wanted to go to lunch counters when they shopping and stuff like that. And to them, it was an issue. And so they had to bring about a change. But we never even thought about that. You know, we would go to the pool room up there and get a hot dog, but we would take it outside and eat it, you know. So standing in there eating a hot dog in the pool wasn't a big deal that back then. But you look at it now, it could have been a turning point if we would have just said, oh, man, I'm not going outside. I'm going to eat right here, you know. And then sticking together would have been another thing. We were a small community as far as blacks, you know, and everybody seemed to be satisfied with what they was doing and never wanted to make a change. Yeah, I guess they say if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And that's where we was, you know. But I just don't know. I haven't talked to people that really... could tell me when it did change.
Mm-hmm.
I left it had to be in 62-3, somewhere down the line, mm-hmm. that at some point they did open up. And then if they did, it wasn't on a large scale. There was certain places that you could go. Because when I left here in 61, the bus station at the corner of 7th and Main, they still had colored waiting room and bathrooms. They still had them up, the signs up there. And so that never changed. And I came back in probably 63, and it was still there, you know. But I think they got more leeway, you know, around 63. The things started opening up a little bit for them because the whites were being exposed to more blacks, where you had one, two, three, now you got seven, eight, nine, you know, and they're coming. It wasn't only here, it was schools from Lexington going down Corbin playing football, basketball, you know, and it was the exposure really opened, made the people see that they had to open up a little bit more in order to really achieve a lot of things, you know. And Corbin was just a place I went through. I never stopped in Corbin too much. Me and my sister went down there one time to shop around Christmas time for my mother. We caught the bus, went down in the little shop. And they were very, very tough.
Where did you go? Do you remember where you went to shop?
It was one 10-cent store, I do recall. I forget the
name. Was it on Main Street?
It's on Main Street. This one 10-cent store.
Daniels or something like that?
Yeah, and it had a lunch counter.
Oh, okay.
Had a lunch counter in there, you know. And I recall we went there, me and my sister, so we was through shopping. We was getting ready to get us a sandwich to go catch the bus and come back home. So the man, they told us, you know, we were down, they told us, sit down, you know, and they're going to fix us a sandwich, you know. And this guy come up to us and said, hey, y'all can't sit down here, you know. If y'all don't get out of here, they're gonna shut me down, you know. So, we, you know, that really scared us, me and my sister. And we got up and, you know, got the sandwich and went on out, you know. But
the cook had told you to
sit down. Yeah, you know, some people, I guess, might have been willing, but they were overpowered by the management and stuff like that, you know. But that was one incident I had down there, you know. And then I played ball there, and one night me and my brother was playing, and the guy going up for a shot, and I told my brother, he was behind the guy, and I was on the side, and I told him, let him go. That's because I was going to block the shot. And so my brother, when the guy went up, my brother went up right up under him and rode him right down the steps, right out that door. And I thought that boy was dead. And I told my brother, I said, man, you know, what are we going to do now? I said, we got to be close together. I said, because you done messed that guy up, you know. And then people, you know, how they felt about their players, you know. And when blacks was in town. But it came out okay, you know. He laid out. They had to take him to the hospital. He was injured. And, you know, you could tell when we started back, they wanted to get a little physical with us, you know, because they was trying to retaliate. Mm-hmm. And I just told my brother, I said, well, come on, let's stay close now, you know. We'll try to do the best we can. We came out all right. But that was one incident. I said, man.
Did you have any problem with the crowd? Or
They was on us. Every time we got the ball, anything, they was on us. I just told my brother, I said, you know, just be cool. Don't try to do nothing else now. You done did it already. Don't kill nobody.
So, I mean, say the crowd was on you. I mean, what was happening?
They were just hollering and screaming, you know. And I said, oh, man, I didn't need this. And it's tough enough. But we managed.
But you got back on the bus okay.
Yeah, the coaches, they kind of like watched out for us coming, you know, getting on the bus and stuff. But it was just so tough, you know. You had to. The kids never was that hostile. It was the parents that was more hostile toward me, and I think my other brothers that played after me, I think that was the same way. You know, it let up, but they were still hostile when the blacks. You know, 'cause my brother was one of the top football players in this time in this community, and he was terrible, and they always tried to hurt him. They were trying to hurt him, but he was a little too tough on him. But he felt, he knew what was going on, you know. And you had some coaches that would come in, and sometimes you had coaches that had never been exposed to blacks. And this created another problem. When you thought you had one song, they would come in, and, you know, and they got their little bigot stuff. And, and then create it again. You know, they try to distill stuff into the kids, you know, this and that. But I think right away they got a hold of that, you know. You know, you're going to be exposed to the black kids, you know, and you got to respect them as, you know, as ball players, you know. You can't just come in here and act like they're nobody. They're ball players, you know. You're trying to succeed. And this was a, this probably was a turning point for them other kids, you know. And they stuck together when they played basketball and football. They stuck together. There's about four or five of them on the team together. So they stuck together, you know, and it made it a lot better for them. I was glad to see that, you know. I just hated to see my brother go out there on his own like I did. And I said, you know, even though the years have changed, they get one-on-one, boy, they'll tear you up, you know. So he had a group with him that was, you know, made it a lot easier for them to be accepted in the communities.
It seems like, from you talking, I mean, there were definitely some communities that were worse than others or had worse reputations than other communities as far as going, you know, either to play ball or just, like you said, going to Corbin to buy Christmas gifts. How was that sort of information relayed to you? I mean, did you just grow up knowing, like, okay, you don't really go to Corbin, you don't really, you know?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, you know, you kind of knew that from being exposed, you know, through the sports or whatever, or hearing people talk, you know, and you kind of knew what you was up against. You know, if you go through Corbin. I used to go through Corbin going to Williamsburg. Mm-hmm. And you know, to go on through Corbin, you know, you didn't want to stop in there. You know, I didn't know the service station.
Why not? What was?
Well, you never knew how you was going to be treated. You know, you might go through on a night and you have a nice guy working at the service station and everything. You know, he's very respectful and everything. Then you might go through there and you have one that really don't even care about you. You know, so you might have to go kind of a little hostile, using the bathroom, something like that might have been a problem. So this is, you know, so you just learn to go on through and go on to Williamsburg. You know, you had a little better connection up there.
But did you know, I mean, I guess, was it ever explained why? I mean, would people just say, oh, don't stop there, or don't go out to Hazel Green, or, you know, don't stop there when you go? Or was it from a personal experiences you had, or did you ever get explained why you don't stop there, you know?
Usually it was people told you about it, you know, like traveling, going north, you knew not to stop in Mount Vernon and Livingston. Mm-hmm. Them are two places that they were known not to accept the blacks, you know, even though they come through there. And just about every black thing, they had the officers down there that would try to get every black come through there. Mm-hmm. And try to put something's wrong. You were speeding and this type of stuff. I was stopped there on several occasions. And you know, they try to create something. But it was just out there that you was black coming through there, you know. And they felt like that all white town, black coming through there, stop them, fine them $50, no problem. Wouldn't be no question, you know. This is how some of them towns, like Mount Vernon and Davidson, this is how they made their money for the city, because they were snopping, you know, and a guy coming traveling, and he's going down south, he comes in and gets stopped, and he's not going to put up a fuss. He's not going to say, you stop and say, well, you were speeding. So, officer, I don't think so. No, you didn't do that. You went along with it and went ahead and paid the fine, you know. You did not question, and they knew this. So they said, we can make us $1,000 this summer, and said, because we know what to do. And the people around here, we knew how to act in them areas. You know, slow down, got a speed limit, then get on out and go to Berea, and then you go county.
Okay.
Yeah, it's okay. But
so people around here knew. Did you ever, how did you pass that information along to people maybe who are coming from, you know, deeper south or up north who are traveling down, you know, 25 at that time? I mean, did you ever give people, you know, if you saw somebody with out-of-state tags or something coming through?
Oh, yeah,
would
yeah.
Would you tell them?
Yeah, we would tell them. I mean, we would even ask the question, did you have any problem with Mount Vernon or Livingston? You know, because I did hang around at a few service stations. I had a friend who worked at a service station that he would stop at. You know, we'd always ask the question, did you have any problems in Mount Vernon or Livingston, you know? And a lot of times they said, man, we never knew it was this tough down here, you know. And a lot of times they would say, no, we didn't have any problem. We got through that all right. I guess it's according to how they felt down there. But
then would you tell them, you know, now as you head down, don't stop.
Oh, yeah.
To get to Williamsburg.
Yeah, I tell them just go straight through. But, you know, and the greatest thing they ever happened when they put the interstate, you know, that way you got around all the cities. All them little towns, you don't have to go through that anymore.
So
you
with
know.
I-75 coming in.
Yeah.
It was easier for people, for African Americans to travel.
Oh, yeah. They felt comfortable about that, you know, because you don't have to go through Mount Vernon. You don't have to take a chance of somebody harassing you because they said you was doing this or doing that. You don't have to do that anymore, you know. Just come right down the interstate and you know, the state man's got to get you now, if anybody out there. It's not going to be that city or the constable or whatever it is. But I would tell them, you know, and a lot of them, that left town, went Ohio, Indiana, up through there. When they would, you know, if people was leaving out, they would always inform them about Livingston and Mount Vernon. And I knew a lot of guys that I ran into really didn't know when I went to Indiana and started working with them. And they found out I was from Kentucky. They would mention them towns. I said, yeah, I know what you're talking about. I said, I had to go through them too, you know. But they had been exposed to the harassment. It's all it was, harassment. You know, they want to try to make it break the blacks down to their rule and everything, you know, and that's all it was about. It wasn't that you was doing so much wrong. It's they felt that they had the control and they could just break you down for them, you know. That's the way that was. But You still got the towns today that are like that. Now, I travel Indiana, southern Indiana, outside of Jeffersonville, and all down to that Indianapolis now. There's some towns I won't stop.
You're still a town.
I make sure when I leave Louisville, I've got a tank of gas. Give me some pop, some water, and whatever, and go straight through. Because you never know. When you get off the interstate there and you're going to McDonald's, you might have to travel 5 miles out there. And sometimes be out in some old cornfield and stuff. You don't know how the people are going to react out there, you know. Because it's still not, it's integrated, but not to the extent where you feel free to maintain. You know, that's the way it is now here in Kentucky, you know. People don't realize it, you know. I have been to that place I won't go. I've been exposed to a lot of stuff, you know. So I know I don't want to have the hassle. I don't have to go there, you know. And it's still like that. It's not going to get like we want it, like it should be. It's going to always be some of that bigotry and all
where
that.
Where do you think it's still like that around here? Do you still not stop in places like Livingston, Mount Vernon?
No, I don't. And I think it still is down there. I mean, it's embedded in the older people, you know, and they try to distill into their kids. Some are successful and some not. The younger kids coming up today that are out there in school and playing sports, they're exposed to a lot of blacks, you know, even though they don't even go to school with them. But they're exposed to a lot of blacks. And I think they do respect them. But how do their parents and grandparents feel about it, see? If that stuff is distilled in you from years ago, you're not going to change. Outwardly, it might look like you have changed. Mm-hmm. Inside, it kills you. You know, and that's the way it's happening today. And people take that the wrong way, you know. And sometimes the blacks get caught up into that, you know. It's good to respect everybody and at the same time demand respect. But don't take it for granted that he's like the person that lived next door to you. It's not like that. And if you travel and just go around people, you'll see this. I've been exposed to it down in Richmond. I lived in Richmond, you know, and I knew how to treat people coming from the city. I knew how to treat everybody. I respect you because I think you're human. You demand respect. But at the same time, same thing comes back to me. If you can't respect me, hey, you got to move on because I am not going to give you no respect if you can't respect me because I'm human. And even though I'm a different color, I demand respect. And this is what the people don't see. You know, some people say, you know, the whites are still saying that we are in control, and it's not like that, you know. We all have an equal part of this, you know, and we got to break it down where that we can understand each other and then respect that person's opinion or whatever. And once we do that, we all can live together, you know, and I don't know if it ever happened. I get along with all people, you know. I'm just that type of person. If I'm in a conversation with somebody and I see that he is not, you know, he wants to be all smart and bigot, and I get away. I don't need that. I need to talk to people that want to treat me like I'm human and talk with some sense, you know. Because I don't really talk on racial problems, you know. I don't talk on that a lot, you know, because I don't feel like nobody should do me a favor. Give me the opportunity to make a change in my life, you know. Because James Brown put out a song years ago, I don't want nobody to give me nothing. Open up the door, I get it myself. See, and that's the way I feel. Just open it up. I go get it. You don't have to bring it to me. I'll go get it, you know. And this is what a lot of people don't see or are not willing to accept, that we are people and that we're smart, brilliant, and we want to achieve. And we want to be just as smart as anybody else, you know. But at the same time, we don't want to go through a lot of changes for that because we think it should be equal opportunity for everybody, you know. And not just a handful. You know, you like this one, so you're going to give him a break. You don't like this one, so they don't care nothing about him.
Freddie, let's back up for a second. You mentioned James Brown just a minute ago, and I was going to ask you about when you were in high school, what your social, your leisure time was like. And that reminded me you were in a band.
Yeah, we had a group here, and I'm not here, me and it was Jimmy McKee and Lee Bush and Jim Handy. Mm-hmm. Me and Jimmy would do a lot of crazy stuff on the buses, and like after we won a game, we'd be coming back and we'd be singing and everything. And the guys talked to us, you know. Jimmy always did play the piano. Said, "Why don't y'all get together and let's have a dance and stuff, you know?" And so me and Jimmy, we thought about that, and then we got Lee Bush, and so Jim Handy, and we started practicing, you know, and we got to doing a few songs from the 50s, and it got to be pretty big, you know. They would come to us whenever there was a dance, they was going to have a dance, a club, they'd want us to sing and, you know, provide the music, and that was a great thing, you know. Jimmy went on and is very successful in the business.
Mm-hmm. He is a jazz musician.
Yeah,
he's a
jazz musician. Detroit.
Detroit. Okay.
He's a Detroit man. Yeah, he's doing great. He's still got his band. He performs. He go as high as 30 some pieces, mm-hmm. you know, according to what the occasion is, how many he needs. But he really stayed with the music. And he made it that was one of his lifelong dreams, is to be a musician. So he made it come true when he got up in Detroit, got with the other guys, and then he got exposed to Motown and some of the stuff there. And he became very successful. I was talking to him in July, and he's steady making the moves, you know. I just hope one day we can get him back down here for a big concert.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if it's possible, but I'd love to see that. But I know it costs some money. Maybe one day we get some, or somebody will pay it. But it was a great time. It was in we did about 3 years together.
What years were those?
58 to 61. Yeah.
What was the name of your band?
James McKee and the Blazers.
And the Blazers, and it was an integrated band.
Right. Jim Handy was that drummer.
Mm-hmm. What instrument did you play?
I sung. Me and Lee Bush were singers. We only had the drums and the piano. And on some occasion, we had another friend, Roy Collier. He played a guitar, one of the best around here. He would participate with us. There was one instance we went to, we played at a group in Lexington at the Phoenix Hotel. And Roy, me, Jimmy, Lee, Jim Handy, and Roy, we went down to the Phoenix Hotel and we sung for the group of, I think it's Kiwanis Club. Mm-hmm. And the big dinner and everything. We sung for them and everything. That was one of our big highlights. We thought it was big time then. We really had some fun.
So, Freddie, we were talking about your band before we switched tapes. What were some of the other leisure activities or things that kids would do at that time in London for fun?
Oh, we were very limited to what we did. Mainly, you know, we usually just would stand on the street and just gather up on the street. And that was, unless somebody had a party, which was very rare, we didn't have a whole lot of selections on what we, you know, could do. We go to Finley's Drive-In right around there and London Drive and places like that. But far as getting together, if the school didn't have a little dance, then we were out of it, you know, until our later years, and we got to going to Williamsburg and places like that. You know, we would reach out and go up there on occasion. Williamsburg, Somerset, places like that, Richmond.
What would you do there?
We would just gather, you know, a lot of places had little small little clubs where the teenagers would gather, and we'd just go there and listen to music, and dance, talk, but it wasn't no big deal, you know. And Richmond, we did the same thing in Richmond, you know, it's clubs down there. We would go. Probably was a little young, but I'd slip in a teenage joint, have a lot of fun. But that's all we did. You know, we'd had to travel to really create any kind of activities for us. We'd have to go somewhere because there was nothing going on around here, you know. And once every 3 months, somebody have a party or something. We'd get together and give a party. But other than that, that was the only recreation we had. Unless it was during the sports season, basketball, football, and then we participated in that, and that was it.
As far as socializing, was it, you know, were most of your friends white at that time?
No, most of them were black.
Most of them were black, okay.
Yeah, I would, you know, we'd just stay with the group, you know, and then a lot of time we'd run into some guys, you know, and some white guys, and we would all get together then. But most of the time we was with the group, the McKees and the McLeans, and we would all just hang out together, you know.
What was dating like? You made the comment a little earlier that you said something about, like, I knew I couldn't go with those girls.
Yeah.
So
dating, and that's one reason why we had to leave. Well, I had to leave London, you know, to find some girls, because around here we were limited, and most everyone around here was kin to me. Mm-hmm. So I'd have to go somewhere else to find the girl and make sure that she wasn't kin to me too, you know. Right? So, but that's the reason why we branched out there, and that there was a few girls here, but there was more guys than there was girls, you know. And if you got a party, then here's a guy trying to talk to girls, you know. So that was our way of just make sure that we was, could find a girl is to leave town. But our dating around here, and that's another thing today, they still have the same problem. A lot of them have learned to live with it, and they've branched out and got girls, But living in a small community like this, most everybody's kin, and a distant cousin or something like that, so...
Do you mean, though, within the African-American or just in general?
In African-American, yeah.
A lot of people are in interracial
relationships and marriages. And that was a big help. Mm-hmm. I mean, it kind of relieved the pressure to guys, because there was other girls they could date, whenever they interracial dating. I don't know what year it came in, I think, but a lot of them were very successful. With the interracial dating. My brother, he's got two brothers married to white girls. They're very, very happy and successful, both of them. And so, they made right choices, And the main thing that they stayed around here, because a lot of people use that to get out of London. They use the girl situation to branch off Ohio, Indiana, wherever, but the ones that stayed they stuck with it, and they are very successful, they've married and got families and doing a great job, but at the time, that would, I look back on the time when I left, and the question comes to mind, would I have made that move if there was other resources available for his, the dating and stuff? Would I have made that move?
And so was it primarily, do you think, the dating, or was it also economical? I mean, were there enough jobs here to support?
Well, I had my little work I did. And I worked, I really did it for myself. I did floors, windows, domestic type work like that. And I was making a little money, but... I think being here all them years and being exposed to other cities was one thing that came into mind. The bright lights, I wanted to witness that, but I hadn't planned to stay. I had planned to do a summer in the city, and I was coming by to go to school and, try to do what I could, yeah. But my brothers, they talked me into staying up there in Indiana. That's okay. I'm kind of glad I did, because my family, I raised a nice family, and everything, grandkids. But at the same token, I might have stayed here, and I don't know if I'd been better off or whether, and then I could have. But, being from a community where you're well known, you have a tendency to achieve a lot, and things will come your way. And going somewhere where you're not known, you got to make it for yourself. It's a hindrance, but I did pretty good in the city, but I do wish that stayed, because I miss being around my brothers when they grew up, and just seeing what they had to go through versus what I did go through, and seeing how different they had it. I would have liked to have been here when they was going out there.
So, Freddie, you left in 61?
61.
And you would have been 18?
18.
Okay.
I was 18.
And where exactly did you go?
When I left London, I went to Culver Military Academy in Culver, Indiana. And I worked at the academy for 2 years.
What did you do there?
I was, we worked as in the kitchen, washing dishes and stuff like that. And they worked on the floor with the cadets.
How did you get that job?
Well, prior to 2 years prior to that, a lot of the guys from East Bernstein and Somerset, they went up there. A guy came down here from Culver and recruited them. So when they got up there, then they wrote back as openings came for other guys. And in the summertime, they always took on extra help. So my brother was up there, so he signed me up, said, "Well, I'll come back." So this is how I got there. And it was it was okay. It was out there in the in the boondocks. The military school was the biggest thing in the community. You know, the town was population was it was smaller than London, but the academy was the biggest thing, and there was a lot of work. I enjoyed it. I was exposed to a lot of stars, kids. They went there, and it was just so interesting. It wasn't no hard work. You know, we did the dishes, and we worked about three or four hours a day. Rest time we had off. But South Bend was only 35 miles away, where I would go for some recreation at night. We'd go to South Bend at the clubs and everything. But I got exposed to South Bend, which is a real large city, you know. So I, dating them girls and, you know, having fun, you know. And then when I didn't come back, I came back for the summer. After summer school, I came back to London. And my brothers, they talked me into going back to Culver. I said, why don't you go on back? You got a job and everything. So I went on back, and I got married. And I met the girl, 61. I got married December 62. You know, I was a little young, but I was ready to take on a wife. But I had a lot of fun up there. You know, work was very slow. 62, 63, real slow. You know, jobs was hard. They wouldn't hire at the factories and stuff. So you had to, you know, just go for yourself. You know, find something to make ends meet, and then finally I did land a job in a factory up there, Oliver Farm Equipment Place in South Bend, and I worked there for about 23 years. I ended up doing 23 years there, but it was a slow starting, but it ended up, you know, in the bank, and later on in the years, his jobs was moving out, selling out, moving out. I ended up lost two or three jobs because of moves. But I came out all right, I guess. Yeah, I raised a family, and the kids are successful. Son went to the military. Did 20 years in the Navy, so he's doing great. My daughter's there. They're all got jobs and doing real good, you know. And I'm really proud of that, you know, and that's one part of my life I would have never been exposed to if I'd stayed here, you know. And I don't know if I'd have had all them kids, and then I had more. I don't know.
How was South Bend different? What was living in the city like?
It was real tough, you know, to get, you're really exposed to the city, you know, coming from the country. It's a big difference, you know. You're exposed to a lot of people, and this is every day. You know, it's not like London where you see them Saturday. You see most of your people up there. It's every day. You know, you see a bunch of people, and to really, you know, you just had to be level-headed and stay focused. You couldn't go in the city and think you knew everything. You know, you had to just stand around, listen, and talk to the people and find out what's going on, and you know what you really. Then you decide what you had to do. You know, the nightclubs. I wasn't used to nightclubs. I mean, you know, every three or four nights a week you go to clubbing and everything, but you had to be careful because there's a lot of bad stuff out there. So it took me a while to get used to that. But after I got used to that, you know, how to deal with people, then I was fired up, you know. I said, you know, I got it made now.
Did you meet other people from this part of the country up there, from Kentucky?
Yes, there was a few guys from Kentucky. There was a few guys from Kentucky. Most of the people I met up there, they were from Arkansas, Mississippi, mm-hmm. Tennessee. That's where, you know, and they came within that 40s, 50s, mm-hmm. They migrated. When things was tough down there, they went up through there, you know. And we got together and we compared stories of things they had been exposed to in their cities, and then I was telling them about London, you know, which they knew it was in the South, and they knew how prejudiced things were here. But we compared all of that, you know, and then we talked about how good they had it up there, you know, considering considering everything that was going on in the South. Things in the North was cool, you know, and you understand, oh, it's not another world, so how can it be so different? And, you know, but it was just the people. It seemed like the South, they didn't want changes. They wanted to keep everything within theirself. You know, when it come to black and white, they wanted you over here and you over here. If we're in the up North, they just, you know, they worked together, they communicated and ate together and stuff like that. But you wonder how come this was so easy there and so tough down South. But I had a lot of good friends up there in the North. But you still have to watch yourself. Everywhere you go, you watch yourself. You know, you don't just feel like you are free as a bird, you know, because there's always some obstacles in the way if you venture on out there, you know. We have a lot of cities up there. I know where I am. Well, I was living in little towns, maybe 20 miles, you know. They hadn't been exposed. No blacks ever lived there. But, you know, so you'd work with guys from them parts, you know, but you really didn't have a whole lot in common just on the job. You know, you couldn't talk about how's your community going, how's people down there. You know, you couldn't talk like that because they were all white down there with no blacks. And, you know, it's going to be like that till the end of time because at just some places, blacks don't feel comfortable going. And the size of the little town or city, you know, the working environment is their work and stuff. So they don't migrate there, you know. And then they don't feel welcome. If they felt like if I go there, will I be accepted in the community or will I be an outcast, you know. And this is what's going down now. And it's going to get, I don't see it get too much better. I see it getting worse because it's coming back.
You think so?
Oh, I know it is. I listen to the news and everything where people burning across up north, northern Kentucky. And you say, why? You know, but is it the young generation? Are they pushed out there by older folks? Or is it their own ideas? I'm sure they didn't learn this in school to do like this unless they went way back there in the 50s and read some of the history of the movement. And then they decide, well, we're gonna take it back 20 years. Mm-hmm. But it's happening.
But at the same time, I mean, there's been a lot of revisiting of the civil rights, and you brought up Emmett Till, you know, and they just had the case.
Yeah, they reopened the case, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, I mean, do you think it's sort of balancing? Because, I mean, I know just, you know, at the beginning of the summer in Durham, North Carolina, there were some cross burnings and
yeah,
this sort of symbolism, there's been sort of outburst at it. But at the same time, it seems like, you know, they've opened the case of Emmett Till and they're finally trying the people who killed the civil rights workers.
Yeah, and I don't see their reasoning behind that because the way I look at it, you made a mistake. Now you, 20 years later, you're going to try to correct this to make us feel good? No. We would have felt a lot better if you justice had been served at the time instead of you bringing it back, this pressure being put on everybody to open up these cases to try to make the blacks see that they are trying to do right. But back then, you didn't do it right. You know they were guilty, but you got them off. So now you're an 80-year-old man. Where are you going to put him at? And, you know, he's not going to change. His way of thinking is still the same. Because I heard a statement made about officer where the old guy was at, you know, and they had him on suicide watch, you know. And the black officer asked him, said, do you think about killing yourself? And he said, no, I'd rather kill you than myself. So this lets you know it's still in him. You know, hey, I'm still against you. But he made the statement to the officer, I'd rather kill you myself. But, you know, I just don't see him going back 20, 30 years and try to satisfy us. Because the people that were murdered, the families, is it going to make them feel good? Or is just they just saying, well, they're just trying to please somebody. Somebody's going to put some pressure on Congress or whatever. And I just don't see that. If they got to wait 20 years, go leave them alone. Because they might slip up and try to do it again, and it won't be as successful, you know. That's the way I look at it. I'm not going to, you know, I respect everybody, but I just can't see you doing people wrong because you're in a position to do this, or your skin color is different, and you can do this and get away with it. That's not good. If they'd have stopped it back in the 50s, there wouldn't have been so much of it. If they'd started putting them in prison, finding them guilty, there wouldn't have been a whole, some of the people that were killed later wouldn't have been killed because they would have thought about it. They said they're not giving us no break, but they knew they get though. We are scot free. We killed a black man, so just one day. But I just don't see what they're doing. The zooming of Emmett Till. I mean, what they said that they was gonna find out if there was more people involved. How could they do that? How could they find out if there was more involved? Seemed like the investigation that took place when it happened to round up everybody that was involved. And instead of waiting, 50 years almost, and say, well, we'll find out and we'll try to find somebody else. If anybody else involved, probably did anyway.
Do you think it's more hurtful to the African-American community to...
I think so.
You think so?
I think so. I don't think it really helped us at all. I think it just it hurt the people. You know, the family didn't want this to happen. You know, they had already accepted the verdict and everything. So why are you going to open the case now? You're not helping the people. You're hurting them. You know, the family said, well, we don't want it to happen, but they said you don't have no choice. We're doing it.
Well, what do you think is the best? You know, what do you think can be done at this point that would help?
What could be done now to help the race relations? Mm-hmm. I think that everybody has to take inventory of themselves and realize that everybody is human. They deserve respect and all the other things that come with living in America. We all have a share in that. I mean, I can't see you because race, religion, deprive an individual of something that is supposed to be valuable to him and free to him. And you say, no, you can't do that. I can't see that. And once the people realize that we're all human and we can come together and agree and treat each other like they're human, then there's not going to be a change. Because the more the whites get away with, the more they're going to try. And if we are not smart enough, or if the law is not smart enough to start giving them justice, then we're hurt anyway. And I try to watch myself every day, but I don't limit myself to one race, you know. I love my black people, but, you know, white folks have been good to me. And I'm going to say it, they have been good to me. And I respect them. But I just can't see them just really messing over my brother because they can. I can't see that. No, I can't respect you. You give him the respect that's due him because he's coming back to you. And once that everybody sees that, then this world is going to be a better place. And if we got to start with our law enforcement, we got our government, and everybody's got to make that change because you got so many of them in the White House that opposes anything that could help the blacks or just bring them up to standard. They oppose that. You know, they want to keep the blacks down. But at the same time, we have the same rights that they do. And if they try to keep us down, we're going to find other ways to be successful. See, and they know that, you know. But we don't have no choice. If you won't give us an opportunity to do the things that everybody else is doing, then we got other means. We got to take other means in doing this. It's so sad that two people can live in the same community, and one is limited to what he can do and what he can't do. You know, and that bothers me. I like to live and just be left alone. You know, I can be your friend. I accept you. You got to accept me. I don't want no favors. Just if you can help me, okay. If you can't, get out the way. I'll do it myself, you know. But I don't want you to try to hold me down, you know, because you think I might be successful in life. And we are entitled to that same success that they've had, you know, and it's showing now in the entertainment field, you know, sports. You know, we've that's one thing that's really made the blacks so successful is the sports. And then you got the entertainment field, the movies, the stars and stuff. They have excelled, you know. And this is one thing that never meant to be happen, but it did, you know. They said they were determined. But the sports figures, you know, they're gonna maintain, and you know, they're gonna keep growing, and it's gonna get bigger and bigger in the sports field, you know. But we've got to get away from just saying sports, money, education, it's got to be our goals as well. If we are successful on the field, we might not be able to play as long. We get all the money. But what do we have to back up on? Our education is limited. And once we get into the education, get our education up there to buy, you know, we'd be all right. There's a lot of successful black people out there and well-educated. And they've did a lot for the community. And to the United States in general, they did a lot.
Did you feel that you had more of an opportunity when you were in South Bend? Did you feel it was more?
No, I really didn't. I really felt like that if I'd have stayed here, I'd have had more of an opportunity to really achieve some of the things I want to achieve here, you know. Because I look at the guys here that stayed here, they are very successful, like McLean's and the electricians and stuff like this, you know, and they were successful here. They didn't have to go to the city to get that.
They were able to start their own small businesses.
There you go. And I thought that, and my brothers, they all worked for Bob and everything, and I thought I could have been successful here and maybe learn a trade. And you know, it wasn't really dependent on them factors and stuff.
So the 23 years you spent in South Bend, you worked for the same factory?
For 23 years, yeah.
23 years. Mm-hmm. And what was your job like? I mean, what was factory life like at that time?
It was really manual labor. There was no easy way of doing nothing. You know, you had to have a strong back to really work in them factories back then. And it was hard work. It was hard. It was hot. But this was the way they did the things, you know, to really make the farm equipment and stuff. And you had to really want to work in order to work in one of them sweatshops like that, you know.
Were you unionized at that time?
We was union, yeah. But it was so tough, you know. You stood a chance of messing up your back. In fact, I messed my back up. I had back surgery in 1979 from all that heavy lifting and everything. But there was no other way to do it, you know. But I see now the factories, now they're automated, you know, and you push buttons and you get some of the same work done. Back then, they did it the old-fashioned way. they did it like they did in 36. You know, they didn't change. I made a lot of money, but I paid for it, you know, with, lost 2 years of work for back injury. But I made a lot of money. But that wasn't something I would really want to make a career of. You know, I would have wanted to have a trade where I could be successful on and off the job. You know, this is what really helps people today. You know, you might work for somebody as an electrician, but you can also do it for yourself and be, you know, and make a living. And that's something I'd wanted, would have wanted to do if I'd have stayed around here. I know I would have been able to work with Bobby and some of the other electricians and probably learned to trade and was able to do it, you know, even if they were slow, then go do some on my own, you know. I would have liked to have that. And a trade would have been my real goal, you know, not just a factory work. When you rely on factories, you know, it's, you might work 6 months, you might work 10 months, you might work 3 months, you know, just according to how their orders come in, you know. So that kind of limits you to what you can purchase and everything because of the way your money comes in, see. And that's something that that hurt me in the city, because raising 4 kids living in the city, you know, and wasn't nothing cheap. And you're not working, so it put a strain on you. I spent a lot of time in the unemployment line. But I was able to make it through, you know. Didn't get rich, but, you know, just kept a family going and kind of stayed happy to a certain extent. But now I look back, my last, 15 years, I have worked in 5 years, so I had 10 years in this one factory, and it wasn't hard work, it was just hot and tiring, you know. But I guess I chose that. If you don't have a lot of skills, then you have to take, in a factory, you have to take a lot of unskilled jobs, you know, and that means a lot of dirty work because you don't have the skills to operate machine. Or really, as you get older, you know, you're not apt to go back there and try to learn all of that. That's a younger trade, you know. When you're a young man, if you learn it, then you'll be all right. But as you get older, you're not ready to devote your little mind to that. Things got better, you know. You was there, I think in 77, I bought my first house in South Bend, 77, because I don't know, I got an opportunity, and my wife was determined to buy a house. I really didn't want a house, you know. I was satisfied renting, having fun, but she was determined, you know, to get them kids settled into something and a good school district. And so we bought a house, and today she's still living in it, and that's where the kids was raised. You know, they had their fun over there. But you know, you get limited to what you can do when you live in the cities. You know, that income is not as great as it should be, and you can't go out there and get $100,000 home because you can't afford to pay for it.
When did you end up leaving South Bend?
I left South Bend in the year 2000. I was I'd had a stroke April 19, 2000, and at the time, me and my wife was separated. So I
and you were retired from.
And at the time, no, I wasn't retired.
Still working.
I was still working. And after the 19th, April 19, 2000, I didn't work anymore. Mm-hmm. That's when I had to go on disability. And I was had met this girl that I had known in the 50s, and me and her got reacquainted. And she told me that you know, that if I came back down here, she would help me, you know, get along. So I chose to do that, which I I think it was a mistake. So I came back in 2000. I got married 2002. I married her in 2002. And we stayed together until...
And you lived here in London?
I lived in Richmond.
Oh, in Richmond.
In Richmond.
Back to Richmond, okay.
I was in Richmond, and I stayed with her till June of 2004. And that's when I got my own apartment. We split up, couldn't make it. So I left and got me an apartment in Richmond. But at the same time, I said, well, I'm going to stay in this apartment for 4 months. And then at this time, I will make my choice whether I'm going back to Indiana or I'm going to London. So at the time, September, my brother was diagnosed with stomach cancer, so he had had surgery in October. In November, he was going to have a chemo and radiation. So I said, well, I see a need where I can go down there and help him out. So I said, well, I'll try to get me an apartment down there. And I applied at the housing authority for an apartment, and they accepted me. So I came down here to take care of him, you know, to help him out. I had made this statement. I won't be here too long because I'm going to stay here a few months and I'm going back to the city. Well, he died in March 1st, 2005. And everybody said, when are you going back to the city? You know, I had made that statement to a lot of people that that's what it was going to happen. So I was up there for 2 weeks and I applied for low-income housing in the city. But I can't do anything because they want me to come there and bring all the information. So, and I was due to be there on the 18th. And the 18th, I told them I couldn't. So it'll be another year before I can apply again. So I guess it'd be next year before I can get out of here. I really want to go back with my great-grandkids. I got a bunch of little great-grandkids, and I see a need, and I need to be in their life to really kind of steer them away, you know, guidance and everything, and be a role model for them, really, is what I really want to do. So hopefully next year, 2006, I might get back up there.
Have you enjoyed your time, though, being back in London?
Oh, yes, it's been very, very exciting, but I find out since I've been back, and it really disturbs me, is the closeness and the love that the families felt for each other when I left, you know. And I'm talking about 40 years. I was expecting to come back and see some parts of that, and that really disappointed me. The way they don't care about each other, you know, they're not close, and we was a close family. All families were close back when I left.
Why do you think that is? I mean, are there still the same? Is it a matter of a lot of people having moved away, or do you just see a breakdown?
I see that the kids are doing it their way. We've lost our older leaders, and some of them lost their parents and everything. So now they're all doing it that way. I don't care about you. I'm going to do this, you know, and this is the way it is. And it's not going to get any better, you know, because they don't really have the role models that we had. Now, we had role models there. I mean, you know, we had your aunt. She acted, when you was out, she acted as your mother. You know, if you got out of line, she would bust you. And now you don't have that. The kids are out here. You can't put me. I tell my mom, you know, this type of stuff. So now the kids are running wild, and the parents are not really doing their job. So they don't really have a role model here.
So there's sort of been a breakdown of the extended family?
Yes.
Where you don't have the aunts and the uncles and that's the grandmas.
Right.
And
that's right. That's the change, you know. And my cousin Joyce, I admire her. She is beautiful. She is trying her best to be a role model for her.
Are you talking about Joyce Carson?
Yeah, our family, you know, because I look up to her, you know, because whenever I'm down and need some information, I can go to Joyce, you know. And she, I know Joyce has got, you know, kids, grandkids. She has a lot on her, but she'll take time and talk with you, you know. And this is, we need more of them. And if the kids realize that there are people in the community that they can look up to, then maybe things will change. But the young generation has went in, and kids having kids, and now you've created something here, you know. And they don't have nobody to look up to, so the kids is not, you know, not going to have a role model. But I really miss that part of living here, because I've walked the streets many a time from school. And if I was throwing rocks or something, and one of the older adults see me, they might snatch me up, might spank me. And then they call my mother and tell them what I did and what they did. So when I got home, I had to answer again, "Mom, you're going to get me." And this was the thing that really kept us going, you know. We knew wherever we was, there was somebody there that took the place as our mother, if our mother wasn't with us. I mean, whether it was at church, school, or a picnic, you watch what you did, because there's somebody there that can dust you. And see, now the kids don't have that. You know, I can do what I want to. My mom ain't here, you know. And it's hurting the whole community. And the parents don't want other people chastising their kids. But this is what's going to make it a real close-knit community and real respectful in the community if you have this. And until they get back to some of the old rules, it's going to be way out. Wow. And I came back here, and I see a lot of stuff going on here that's really good. But also I see there's not enough people participating to make it a success. Something like the center here, if this had been going 20 years ago, it would have been a big success there, because you had the role models, you had the leaders, and the people that would have been concerned. Today, they are not concerned. They don't realize how big a deal this is and can be, because you're reaching back to your heritage from years ago, and the kids have an opportunity to learn something about their people years ago that they will never know, you know. Because, you know, they can come here and maybe go on the computer and find out their ancestors and where they came from and some more of their kin folks, you know. But I think this center is one of the greatest things that ever happened. I support it. But I just can't get enough people here to see that. I can't. And I came here, and when I heard about it, I talked to my brothers. I said, you know, this is one of the greatest things that ever happened. I said, you know, if your father was here, your mother was here, your sister, y'all would all be in there. My sister would have made sure everybody here in this town, because she would have walked miles to make sure they knew what was going on. She was an advocate for, you know, for rights. She would have just picked it up and really went wild over it, you know. But the other people think that it's not to benefit them. And this is really what it's for, you know.
Why do you think that there's been a lack of involvement? Why do you think people don't care, don't think that it's a concern of their life, you know, learning about history and their local history, their family history? What do you think that lack of involvement that you see is about?
You know, that's something I've been trying to get in my mind and try to figure it out. Some of them think it wasn't my idea, so I'm not going to support somebody else's idea. And this is the way a lot of them think, you know. And a lot of them, their history is here, you know. A lot of the people in this community, they want to church right here, you know, and they know how important their family, the roles they play, their families played in the growth of London, and not to be wanting to be a part of it is really stupid. You know, because I think that if this was going, I'm going to go back 10 years ago, you'd had some of the old guys that had died on. My father, one of them, he would have been right up in here, you know. He would have did whatever it would took to make it a success. And a lot of people say, well, I don't want to be a part of it because I'm not the head of it. See, and you got that thinking in the black community. And it really hurts me. I don't care who starts it, be a part of it. You know, it was his idea. Put your little bit in there. 5 years from today, you might be ahead of it. You don't know. But just participate. Make everybody, let everybody know that you are very much concerned about the heritage of your ancestral community, you know. And this is a guy asked me at the oldest. He said, you know what would be a great thing to happen in London would be if oldest and goodest and the Senate would come together as one organization and work together. How big could it be? We don't have enough blacks here to kind of separate ourselves. We need to all work together. You got 20 over there and you got 10 over here, and the rest of them don't care. If you pull together, then you're going to be successful. And everybody's going to want to help. They want to be a part of it. You know, and in the community, they're going to say, okay, we see what they're doing. Let's put in a little money there. Let's make it bigger and broader, you know. And then on the once a year when you have your big annual meeting, I mean, Lord have mercy, just think how big it could be. But the guy asked me that. I said, how come? I said, man, I don't know. And the oldest, they don't want to talk about it.
You're talking about the oldies and goodies. Oldies. It's a heritage reunion that happens in the summer.
Yeah, and this Heritage Foundation, they can all work together. It would be the greatest thing in the world. You know, they could have their fundraisers, and then they could have their one annual meeting, and at the same time, you got a meeting over here, the oldest, you know, the way they have their little thing, and with a speaker, and then they could come tour the center and see what the progress that is made from year to year, and it would be a great thing. It would be a great thing. I don't know why they won't do it. They don't even want to talk about it. And my brother is one of them. He's a financial man for the oldest. And I talked to him. I said, man, why don't y'all want to do this? Your organization is not so big and broad that you're so wealthy and that you cannot just come down and sit down and say, okay, let's form us a committee. We'll get three from the Heritage Foundation. We get three from the oldest and goodest. And we'll get a committee and we'll all work together. And we'll make it a place where the people coming by can see the progress that has been made in this little community. Right now, they come back, oldest and goodest, they haven't made no progress. I mean, every year it's the same old thing.
There's the same people coming.
Yeah, and you don't see what they have achieved. What did you achieve throughout that year? Nothing. And the heritage, you know, this is an organization that it would, in a year's time working together, it would grow so large that when they come back, they say, oh, y'all have really progressed, and we're going to make a nice donation to this because y'all really doing something, you know. Until that, it's not going to work. I mean, old and good is not going to last too much longer.
And one of the things that we haven't talked about, but I think is related to this, is church. Right now we're sitting in the Laurel County African American Heritage Center, which is on the corner of Mill Street and Short Street, which was the old Mill Street Baptist Church. And one of the things you're talking about, the breakdown of the community that you were surprised to see, another explanation or reason that people oftentimes offer up to why that is the breakdown of the African-American church. That, you know, this church closed, and you're talking about not having leadership, that at one time the leadership came from the pulpit, came from the reverends that, you know, people like Reverend Hill, that were here, that led, you know, people coming together, you know, this church, church out in Altamont, you know, people still, even though you went to your separate church, you all came together.
That's true.
At some point, and you had a space to gather. And now, I mean, there's Altamont, but it's not a very large congregation.
No.
But most people have, you know, integrated and go to white churches.
Yeah.
Now, do you have any thoughts about how, what did church used to be like? Did you used to come to Mill Street?
No, I went to the Christian church.
You went to the Christian church?
That's where I was a member of the Christian church. And the Christian church at one time was probably the largest one.
And it was all African American.
Right.
And where was the Christian church located?
That's on North Main Street.
North Main Street.
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was a church. You know, we had a simple service. We had a pastor, Evans, Reverend Jack Evans was our pastor down there. And he was a type of minister that, you know, he didn't rely on the church to make his living. He had a job, and he just preached on Sundays, you know. And we was probably the only church around here that had, for 30 years, the same minister. Here at the Baptist church, they've had, I've known at least four different ministers they had here, you know, because they would have to travel. We had one from Louisville, Shelbyville, you know, they came from afar, you know, but they never lived here. And so they would alternate every other Sunday. And that same way at the Christian church. When the Sunday they had church at the Baptist, we didn't have church. So we came from the Christian church to the Baptist church for service. We had Sunday school. We let out Sunday school. We now come here for church. And that kept bonding for all the churches, you know. And when we had church down there, they came down there. So this kept a bonding of all the churches, both of the churches. And we had what they call a fifth Sunday meeting, which would be between the Baptist and the Christian in Altamont and East Bernstein. And, you know, there was a dinner on the ground, basket dinners, and stuff like that, and preaching all day. That was a great thing there, you know, and we had the great leaders, and it was just so great, you know, and you couldn't wait for that fifth Sunday because you got to see everybody, and there wasn't a whole lot of fussing and fighting in the church, you know. In fact, it was very simple. There wasn't a whole lot of money. And we did down at the Christian church. I think they rebuilt on two occasions, built a church. And they did that through raising money and stuff like that. And they also had some donations from the Christian organization of town, the white church. They gave some donations and stuff. And that really kept us going, you know. And they didn't feud. Like in churches now, you're gonna feud over the money and eyes operating, and then this is really something that back then they didn't have. You know, they would take what they had, they paid the light bill and the water bill and stuff like that, and they didn't have a whole lot of expenses as far as the pastor would charge. I think they must have gave him about $6 or $7 when he preached, you know, and he was happy with that, and he had a big family too. But it wasn't money is a thing in churches now that the small churches cannot survive because lack of membership, and it's creating a problem. To get a minister in a church now, it probably costs you about $75 of service, and it really that's one thing that really hurt this community when you had to start reaching out for ministers to bring them in. I know the Christian church. the last minister, they haven't had a minister down there to really be an ordained minister in quite some time. Brother Garland, Arlington, he was the last one they had. He's a great speaker. I like him. And he was the last one there, but he felt like that there was no growth for the church. You know, you're sitting still right at you're at the point where you got all you're going to get. So what are you going to do? They're trying to still operate down to about 15, 20 people, but they're not doing it right. But I don't know how they must get an ordained minister to come in there to try to turn things around and get all the boards in place so that they can make a run for it, you know. And don't feel like that right now you're doing all you can do. There is things that can be changed and make it a success if you wanted to, you know. Some people get set in the way they're doing it, and they're, oh, we're doing okay. They're not, you know, because you're not drawing in nobody new. And when you start bringing in people into your congregation, you say, hey, we're doing something right. And that's why I went to church down there for 20 years. I don't go there now because I don't feel like the leadership is there. And what I go to church for, I'm not going to get there. So I have chose not to, but I'm going to join another church somewhere. But this is one thing about the church, and once the church is the bonding of the community in a certain sense, you know. If you got a great church in the community and people gathering and everything, then it helps bond that community, you know. And you know where you need to go to get your religion, be fed, and also meet your friends and talk about different things, you know. But when you don't have that, it's just a lost cause. But I don't know what they're going to have to do. And I have made some suggestions, but everybody said, well, you haven't been here long enough to really. But, you know.
What are your suggestions, Freddie?
Huh?
What have been your suggestions?
First thing you're going to have to do is sit down and reorganize. Because right now, You're running on an organization that is not benefiting you. So you got to sit down, and then you talk about, okay, we need a minister. And we're going to have to reach out there and get an ordained minister to come in here to help us. And then I think once they do these two things, then they're going to pull some of the people from the community. Because a lot of people that live here might go to Altamont because they feel like they're more organized and got an ordained minister. But at the same time, they might go down here. If once you organize and they see that things have turned around and that you are just about on the right track, and then I think that it would be a different program. You know, don't be satisfied with what you got. Always try to get more. And then they talk about the some of the members going to the white churches. I said, well, whatever they're looking for, they get it there. And if you can't offer it here, then why you think they should keep coming? What have you got to really offer them, you know? And so my nieces is there, you know, down at the church, and Jack Riley, and you know, and they're good people, but the organization is not on the right track. And I say, you know, if you listen to somebody, it don't have to be me, but somebody that's a little older and kind of a little wiser and see how things were was years ago. And you're looking at it can be similar to that now. You know, y'all just do it right. My father was there until he died. You know, he was a member. He was a member of that church till he died, and things were different. Because there was a lot of stuff that goes on he would never let go on. And he was determined. My aunt, she died. She was, in fact, she was my Sunday school teacher when I started there. And she was one of the greatest women. And she tried to keep the church, you know, in order and the organization. And had people on the board in key spots, you know, that really, really was concerned about the church. And once they got out and stopped going, got sick and couldn't go, then that's when it fell apart. But my sister was there too, and she was a great leader. And but as she died, then people felt like that, hey, we can we do it our way. And young people have a way of, they think it's right. They have a way of doing things, but I don't care. You know, when you get my age and you came from the old school, that same stuff that worked then can work now. If you apply it in the right way, you know, you can't just say, okay, let's do this. You got to apply it in the right way. You know, you're not being old-fashioned. You're just using some of the things that work in the olden times today. A lot of people are doing, a lot of churches are doing it. And they're being successful, you know, the minister. And you don't have to get a minister and you have to pay him $300 a week. You don't have to get one like that. You know, because in this community, you're not, a minister is only going to preach. You might have Bible study Wednesday, Sunday preach. And you can't afford to build him a house or pay for it. You know, sometimes the minister has to kind of help himself until he sees fit that we've got an organization or we got a congregation that can really pay you, you know. And I admired the ministers years ago when they got very little. There was one, they told me, the minister down at Altamont, he used to come from Louisville. And sometimes he wouldn't get nothing. And he drove Louisville. But he wouldn't get nothing, maybe a meal. But he kept coming. And he kept the organization together, even though he wasn't getting paid. But he was determined to do what the Lord set him out to do. You know, and then this is what it takes now, the dedication to whatever you're doing, to make it a success. And if you're dedicated to it, there's no way it won't be a success. But if you're just messing around or trying to just see how much money you can get, it's not going to work out. You got to put a lot of work into it, and you know, in order to be for it to be a success. And that's why I think this organization can be a success.
The
you know.
Center.
The center, yeah, it can be a success if they would all just, everybody's got to work together. We got to feel like a family, you know, and
Freddie, we've been talking a lot about some of the things going on right now in the community. Can you tell me what do you think are some of the biggest changes overall that you've seen for African Americans in London, in Laurel County, in your lifetime?
The biggest changes. Well, some of the changes, some of the bigger changes that have taken place is the ability for some of the African-Americans to be independent for us when it comes down to jobs and stuff. This is one of the biggest changes. And to broaden the field, you know, it's the electricians, the plumbers, and if people would, the guys that need jobs, if they would latch on to these guys that are in this business, they can be successful too. But this is one of the biggest changes that has taken place. When I left here, there was electrician, which Bobby was starting off being an electrician.
Bobby
McLean. Okay, so then I come back, and Theodore Baker, he's a plumber. He's gone, done got his plumbing license and everything. So now he's a plumber. And then from Bobby took on a lot of young men. He taught them to trade. Okay, after they learned to trade from Bobby, they worked for Bobby, and then they branched off and did it themselves, for themselves, got their own organization. And that's the same way with Theodore. He taught a lot about the trade for his plumbing, and right now they're successful. There's two or three successful. But we won't forget about now, one of the first black plumbers around here was Lawrence McLean. Now, he was one of the first black plumbers around here. He didn't have a whole lot, because when he was a plumber, everybody was too young to participate in him. He did it on his own and stuff like that. And the whole time, he didn't take on a lot of young men, and he never gave them an opportunity to learn the trade from him. But he was one of the first black men. But when Theodore came, he hired the younger guys and taught them a lot about it. And, you know, and then when he got sick and went down, then they were able to continue on his work. And right now, after he died, then there are still 2 and 3 plumbers that are very successful. You know, they can go out and bid on jobs and big contracts and stuff. That's the biggest change around here. Now, I know Wayne, he's a great construction worker, you know, remodeling and stuff. He's great at that, you know. He does carpentry. Yeah, he does that real good, you know. And he has an opportunity to be very, very successful. And it's, I mean, I think he could be one of the biggest ones around here. If he would just, because he knows so much how to do so much. He worked in the city, and you know, as a maintenance repairman at the high-rise buildings, stuff like that. And he has an opportunity to be one of the bigger ones around here. If he, you know, he ever make up his mind, it's what I want to do, and get him 2 guys that work with him, you know. And until these guys get straight and they got the skill, until they are straightforward with it, they're not going to continue if they try to cut it short and everything. You know, I'm really proud of the guys around here that are successful. But there's been a lot of them that had an opportunity and they did stupid stuff and they're not in business, you know. But in order to be successful, you got to be honest with people. And, you know, you got to be able to do the job, to be it. And be honest with them. Don't try to cut them short and don't try to make them look stupid. Go ahead and be honest. That's one of the biggest changes around. Now, there's not too much more that they can work at. You know, I know they work at Walmart and places like that. But that's, you know, working for somebody else. But when it comes down to them being really successful and making a difference in the community, them are the things that's really did it.
One thing we don't have, though, in the community is there aren't a lot of African-American professionals. You know,
true.
Doctors, lawyers.
We
haven't gotten to that point yet.
No, we're short on that end.
Why is that?
I know we have a lot of African-American doctors, but I guess, you know, here in London, their skills, I mean, they're very successful other places in London. And to really maintain, say, a heart doctor or something like that, it really wouldn't happen. You probably got some in Louisville, in places like that, but I don't think that big doctors would come this way. Because I don't think the market would be set up for them. I think right now we got a lot of the foreign doctors. They've come here and they've set up their practice and they are being successful. But you know, if you're already set up, you wouldn't want to go back to a little town like this. Mm-hmm. And I think that's one reason. But and another thing that would really bring on the bigger African-American doctors would be hospitals. If they would be successful, build a new hospital, make it bigger and everything, I think this is where we're going to get the black doctors will come in and set up. But right now the hospital is so small, so right now your best bet is to go to Lexington, set up in Lexington or Louisville, because this is where they're going to end up at anyway, see. So this is one thing that's holding them back. I think the hospitals, if they were bigger hospitals, I think we'd have some of the better doctors here, some of the black ones. But we do need more professional people here in this community, and we don't even have a officer on the city from this story?
We do have, there is a African-American state trooper.
That's right.
Jack Riley.
That's the only one.
But there's not one in the city.
And I think we should have one. I think we should have a sheriff. But, I mean, who qualifies, you know, or do they, the qualification can't be that great that they can't put them in training. And then the people that cheer the blacks, sometimes, you know, they don't look for as a profession like that because they're, I don't know, they want to give orders or protect the people or crooks themselves, you know, and they just don't go into that. And I think we do need that in this community. And by it being a small community, you don't have a spokesman for the blacks. Who do we have to go out there? Say, I mean, go to the board and say, look here, we got 50 police. You don't have one black now. What are we going to do about that? I mean, I'm sure the quota, everybody has a quota of minorities in every city, you know, and you got to reach that. But nobody's ever made an issue here, and I don't think it's going to happen until somebody speaks out there and say, hey, we got X amount of police. We need at least two blacks now. Where are we going to get them from? We need to work on it. A sheriff in our police department for the city. But until we do that, you know, it's people here seem to be satisfied, complain amongst each other, but don't take it where it can be heard. And this is what you got to do. So what if they say, well, that ain't your business. Don't let it die. It's okay, I'll be back later then. Talk to you later. But don't let it die, you know, because if you shut down the first time they say, we don't have to worry about him coming back. But you got to keep it up. And if I lived around here, that's what I would do. If I was going to live here the rest of my life, I would be trying to get on the town board or whatever to make my voice heard. My brother in Williamsburg is on a commission up there, city, and he's very active in politics. But he left here and went up there, and he got, you know, dealing. He was he worked with Bobby as an electrician and stuff. He was one of Bobby's right hand men years ago, and he left him and went to Walmart. But he also worked with the community. And he got into politics. And, he landed in this job. And he speaks out, you know, and it kind of helps him out up there whenever they come short with the minorities. You know, he speaks for them, you know. And this is what we need here. If we go get one on there, I think my niece, she wanted to go get on the commission, Paula Bush. But she ran for office and didn't get elected. But we need one out there, and even go to the meetings like Wayne goes. If you get two or three to go, you know, and find out what they're doing. If you don't know what they're doing, then you don't even know how you could help or what. But find out what they're doing here, you know, because there's a lot of secret stuff that goes on here, and it cuts out the minorities because there ain't none there. But this is what we're going to have to do in this community, and we don't have... We don't have the old leadership. We don't have none of it. Bobby McClain, he's probably one of the older guys here. He's 70, about 70, going 70 years old, you know. He's a successful electrician, you know. His business, he probably don't get a chance to go to meetings and stuff. But that would be one of our leaders that we could push out there to be a spokesperson for the minorities. If he would, you know. I know his time would be limited, but that would be one I could think of that has a level head on him and has an idea how things should be run in the community. That's one guy there, and I would vote for him anytime, you know. There's not too many more that I would say go out there, you know, that we could put out there with the level here and be able to communicate with the people. You know, I don't see too many more.
Overall, Freddie, how do you think that race relations have changed in and around London?
Well, they've got bigger, and I hope they've got better, you know, with the interracial marriages and stuff like that. But that was one of my bigger things here that really was plaguing the people and creating a problem too, you know. But once this opened up for the interracial and the young people felt comfortable with it, it opened up a lot of avenues. Probably made a lot of people mad, but that's so much, you know. And it's the race relation has got somewhat better. But at the same time, it's a little tense because you say, even though you got an interracial marriages, dating and stuff, are they limited where they can go and feel comfortable, you know? So this makes it kind of scary, you know. You have to stay within your bounds to really, well, you get some help if something went down. That's the way I see it, you know. Just don't say, well, I can just go anywhere. You ain't going to be able to buy anywhere. Interracial marriages won't be able to go out here and these new additions and buy houses. They're going to cut them down every time. They're going to find a reason not to sell to them. The only way they could do that would be that they had some high-powered backing from some individual that would help them push them out there, you know, and say, okay. But other than that, I think the interracial dating, the marriage was great, but I still think they're limited to where they live and how successful they can be, because they're going to cut you back, you know, some of them. Some of them are going to do it. Some of them don't really care. They're out to do whatever they have to do to be successful, you know. And my hat's off to them type of people. Don't let them scare you, you know. Just stand up for your rights and your family. Don't let them scare you. And don't be a yes man. Voice your opinion. Because, you know, they think they're right. Hey, and oh, man, I don't think that's right. You know, let them know. Then I think when you start letting them know how you feel, they're going to respect you more. But if you agree to everything they say, then, oh, man, we got him. But just be having an opinion about everything, even though it might be right. But say, well, but we can do this. You know, always counteract, you know, have a rebuttal there. Said, oh, I think we can do this and make it a little bit more successful, even though it's already all right. But you shouldn't just go what they say. But I never, race-wise, you know, other than, you know, back when I was here and the motels and the restaurants was a big issue. I never had a problem, you know, and we already knew our boundaries for the girls and all that stuff. We already knew that, so that wasn't an issue. But since I've left, they just broadened the whole thing, you know. Some of them go along with it. Whether they agree or not, they go along with it. Because a lot of them at the time, when this came into focus, a lot of fathers and mothers was standing a chance of losing their daughters because of the way the daughter felt, and they didn't agree. Well, they say, hey, I'm going to do it anyway. We go to New York. We go, you know, and no, they want them to stay right at home. So they agreed to this different things, even though they might not have liked it, but they agreed to keep the family intact. And then as the years went on, they grew to like the individual. And say, it wasn't a bad deal after all. You know, she loves him. And we got to like him because we want the best for our daughter, you know. And this is the thing, and this is what a lot of whites found out, that the guy ain't that bad, you know. You're creating a problem where there wasn't no problem. You're creating it by, you know, jumping on him, or you tell your daughter don't want him and call him all kind of thing. And then the girl said, "I'm gonna marry him anyway." So what? And then you know, you have him over for dinner. He's maybe a little skeptical about it. And he come over, y'all sit down and talk, and you get to liking the guy, you know. Y'all have a few things in common. Then, you find it ain't so bad, and then you accept your grandbabies and a happy family. But that's another thing that they're, them grandbabies, you know, they don't take to them too often, especially if it's out of wedlock, you know. They don't do that, and that's not only here. That's in the city too. Now, I've seen it happen in the city, you know, where they don't want nobody to know that they got a biracial kid as a grandchild. They don't want that, you know. And then maybe later on it leaks out, you know, and they approach the lady and she said, "I thought you knew." But she knew they didn't know because she was trying to keep it hid. Because she, in a sense, was ashamed of the way it went down, and by being biracial, they were just ashamed. But that's what makes up the rainbow all different colors. And people don't realize that, you know, it takes all different colors to make a rainbow. So we got all kinds of people. We got Asian, African, blacks, whites, biracial. We just got everything, you know, and I don't see nothing wrong with it. Why can't we all live together? I know we all, we break them down into rich, poor, or poverty, but we can all, as far as the race, we can all just live together and be happy. I do think, you know, and until then, the people look at it as a reality, it won't work out, but the race is a lot better. The issues, you know, and I'm glad of that, you know. I went up north and, you know, I was with my black folks, and I never thought about, if I'd have stayed here, I probably would have thought about marrying a white girl, you know, because that would have been, that's where I would have had a choice, you know. But by me going up north, you know, I'm just, you know, with the blacks and everything, so that was the way it was. But I know if I'd have stayed around here, I would have had that choice.
Freddie, are there any other changes that you've observed in your lifetime within the community here?
For good or bad?
For good or bad,
yeah. the biggest change that really affects me and that bothers me is the closeness of families. This is the one that hits me the most. I come into town, you know, and I see it in my family. You know, we're not close. Back when my mother and father was living, we was close, and we always on holidays gathering, we was all there together. And if I came into town, all my brothers would be there, you know. Now my brothers, sometime they go a couple of months without seeing another brother, and they live right here. I said, "Well, what is the problem? You know, why can't you see him?" Well, they're all set, and they got things to do, and they're not gonna bend from a routine to go see their brother. So I talked to my brother. He's on Thursdays I mow. That's okay. And he's on Friday I weed eat. And because I want to say, "Well, come on, let's get together on Friday." You know, me and you and a couple other brothers, we just sit around and talk old times and stuff. But he's got that routine. He's not ready to break that. And I don't think that I've never got into a routine when I did anything, couldn't break away. I mean, if the day was the day I washed my car, if you say, "Hey, Perry, let's go here and give it to the other brother," I say, "Okay, wash the car and wait next week." But that's the way I was, you know. And I, getting together is a thing that really excites me. Now me and my brothers, when we get together, we have a lot of fun. I'm talking about, we go back, talk about each other, old times and the whoopings we got, the whole bit. And this is really exciting. Now in September, first September, Labor Day weekend, we'll be together. We'll be minus one, that the one that died, but it'll be six of us together. And we'll all get together. I hope I can get them together. That we can, you know, sit around and just talk and just clown and act like a family. Families don't act like families. And they're talking about a family reunion should be every day. I mean, if you got 10 of your family members living here, that's a reunion every week. Get together on Sunday or sometime and just, you know, don't wait till once a year. You know, and this bothers me. We had so much fun years ago. 4th of July, we'd have a picnic somewhere. Everybody was there. Christmas, my grandfather in our house, we'd alternate. On Thanksgiving, we'd alternate for dinner at our house and then at theirs. We were together. Christmas, we shared open gifts together. This was the way we did it. Now they don't do that. I mean, I was here Christmas. I was at my apartment. I don't even think I went nowhere. You know, because, you know, my brother, he cooks, but he didn't invite me, you know. And I said, well, I'm not going to infringe because he might have some other guests. I'm not going to infringe, but if he invites me, I'll be there. But this was a thing. It wasn't an idea you had to be invited. It was just that, hey, that's my brother. I'm going around and see what he's doing. But right now, they don't do that. And I got one brother, works at Kroger's. He don't visit nobody. I see him twice a week at Kroger's. He'll tell me, oh, man, I know I'll be off Thursday. I'll come by your house. I ain't seen him since. Almost a year, I ain't seen him. But you know, it's just that he's in church, and he feels like his obligations require more of his time, and he don't feel like that the family is important. And I don't know whether he feels like he's better than the rest of them, but in order to be a real good Christian, you must participate with the family, love everybody, and try to greet everybody. You know, try to see them. You know, this is what really makes a real upstanding Christian to me. I mean, the love that you showed for your fellow brother or sister or whatever, this really overpowers your knowledge of the Bible. Because God was all about love when he was down here walking, you know. And he didn't shortchange nobody. If he shortchanged back then, we wouldn't be where we are today. But it's all about the love that you show your fellow family members. You got to have this. And I don't care. I don't care where you go or who you with. You'll always want your family. And you know, my family up in the city, My son, he is he's the only man, you know, he's head of it, you know, with the sisters and stuff. Now, whenever he gets something in mind that he wants to do, now he's going to do it. You know, like he called me right after the 4th and he said, Dad, if I come down there, will you come back with me for a couple of weeks? And I said, sure, man, I'll come back with you. So he drove down here and picked me up. And took me back up there, showed me a good time, brought me back, and we had a great time, you know. And that's what families are, you know. If one can't go, somebody go get him and bring him to the other members, and let's all have a thing. That's what he did. He saw that it was going to be a problem, you know, with me, with money and get my car straight. So he said, I'll go do it. I'll go pick Dad up. And he wants me up there. I mean, I tell you, if I went up there, he'd have a 100% turnaround his life, because he misses me so much. You know, a lot of things we did, like on Father's Day we go fishing and stuff like, so he misses me. Now if I move up there, he's going to be one of the happiest guys in that whole community, because he's going to say my dad's here now. So you know, he'll be able to, if he has a problem, come on and talk to him about it. Not that I have the answer, but you know, somebody to talk to, you know, and do little things. So I'm proud of that, you know. But I just want to see these people here to love each other and try to get together right now. Don't wait. You know, a lot of times families don't see each other till a death or something. Now they're all together. Then they go month at a time and don't see each other. Do it every week if it's possible, you know. And they don't live that far apart. I don't see why. And in a week's time, you shouldn't see your brother or sister living right here at least once a week. I don't see why. I try to do that. I go see every one of my brothers, try to see them and talk to them. and see how they're coming along, you know. But I know they got things they got to do. And then a lot of times they think because if they come around that you might want some money or something. You know, a lot of families are like that. I got a little bit, so he ain't got nothing. So when I see him, he's probably going to be begging. You know, they feel like that. He's what a happy brother, you know. He needs some help. I ain't got nothing, but I'm trying to help him. That's me. That's Freddie. I'm not going to change because I think I'm on the right road. You know, I don't have a whole lot, but I have love for everybody, you know. I just love everybody because I think there's some good in everybody you meet. And I don't care what they do. I think there's still some good in them.
Yes. Okay.
All right. Is there anything that we haven't touched on yet that you'd like to talk about as far as your life or what London, living in London, used to be like?
Well, I don't see it, but I still would like to see this whole community, for them to come together as a community and get back to where they used to be, you know. I love to see that, you know. Quit holding grudges and holding things against people. I don't like that, you know. And I think that once they see this, they all can get better. Our churches will grow. Our community will be a better place to live, you know. Our center here would be something that would be a drawing card for other members of the community. And once we get together and iron out these little differences that some people think they got against somebody, and I think this is going to be the turning point. Until they do that, it's not going to work. I don't care what they do. I don't care what they do. It's not going to work. You have to come together as a community. Be like it was years ago. Even though a guy's wrong, just come and say, "Hey, brother, how you doing?" And go from there. Don't if you say something to offend you, don't associate with him for 6 months. Come to him, you know. And this is on this thing that is gonna make this community grow. We got a lot of black people here. If they would only half of them get together, then we'd be a great community. But they're just so far apart, you know. And I understand that everybody's got their own thing. Everybody's making their living, and they got a little money and everything. But look at the point that one day you might not be able to do that, and you're gonna have to call on somebody. So right now you keep that up there, the friendship and the love. And then when you do get down, everybody say, "Hey, you know, old man, old John over there, he's down there, but let's go over there and see what he needs." So everybody come over there and say, "Hey, man, you need roofing put on or something like that." You get that help. But if you don't communicate with them, you don't have nothing coming whenever something happens. You know, and never get too high that you can't look down. See, and this is it, you know. And on your way up, try to pull somebody with you. You know, just reach back and grab his hand. "Come on, brother, we can go." You know, don't try to be up there by yourself. See, I was out there on my own, and not by choice, you know. It just happened like that. I don't want to be the only black nowhere, you know. I'm reach down and pick up another one and say, "Come on, let's go. We can go to the top. Hold on to me," you know. And this is what we have to do. Just don't think that we've got the knowledge to achieve, but we're not willing to help somebody else up the ladder. We're so in a hurry to step on them, to keep them down. No, you pull them with you, you know, because the more you get to the top, the better it's going to be for you. You'll have a tough time with that by yourself. Get some more up there with you. Now you got something to fight with, and that's the way I look at it, you know. I don't want to be the only one. I want to have somebody there with me that has the same knowledge and want to go the same place I want to go. You know, this is me.
So, Freddie, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Yeah, I really enjoyed this talk. Yeah. Right.